Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door.
I'm not even gonna swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know and they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Wait right there, Mr. Pinnell.
How do you know my name? I didn't tell you my name.
Hang up.
I didn't tell them my name.
They're all a part of it. They're all pods, all of them.
Do you ever wonder about all the different ways of dying? You know, violently. I wonder, like, what would be the most horrible way to die?
It's not my intention to do this in front of you. For that, I'm sorry. But you can take my word for it. Your mother had it coming.
Mommy, I want to see the bad man fly.
Make the Batman fly!
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
I just can't take no pleasure in killing them.
There's some things you gotta do. Don't mean you have to like it.
Seven days.
Wait a minute. I know who you are. Yeah, but I heard you were dead.
And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming. And the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan,
this is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
It is going well.
Excellent. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, how's it going?
I'm doing well.
And in the state of Connecticut?
Wishing I was back on the roof of the Contemporary Resort in Walt Disney World, but I'm here in Connecticut.
And
like
who
I
is that?
Am.
Who is that?
It's Chrissy Peters.
That's right. That's right. And Mike may or may not join us. He has an obligation for his job as a school teacher. There's open house for the parents to meet the teachers. So
blah blah job educate children blah blah.
Indeed. So first off, Eric, what does everybody know about another podcast that you do with your buddy Dan?
I do a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on Stitcher or on the iTunes Store.
Very good. And Abe, you do a genre blog.
Yep. It's called A Reeler Movie Reviewer. Reeler spelled R-E-E-L-E-R, Movie Reviewer. You can find it by going to a basic search engine, or you can visit Dark Discussions' webpage and look on your right-hand side. You'll also find links to other goodies, as along with like Eric's blog and Mike's as well.
That's right, and Mike's not here, but his blog is unnaturalselections.com. It's a genre blog that he occasionally posts to. And Chrissy, you do a online magazine, or and you do some writing and such. Why don't let folks know where they can find you?
Yeah, I do more things at the same time than are healthy, but you can basically find out about me. I'm a short fiction writer. I do have a short story collection out, and I do have a novel out, couple of things out, lots of short stories all over the web in various magazines. You can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com. And if you butcher my name, don't worry about it. Just Google it. I'll show up.
Yep. And that would be S-E-N, so the Norwegian spelling of Peterson, and Schoonover is S-C-H, the German way. And what was I going to say about that? What are the title of that book? It was related to where you were just mentioning, something about contemporary.
Yes, Skeletons in the Swimming Hole, Tales from Haunted Disney World. It's ghost stories set in Disney parks. My novel is called Bad Apple, and I also have a novella out there called This Poisoned Ground.
Nice. And for those who don't, or actually, as Abe said on www.darkdiscussions.com, for those who don't remember any of these things, they can just go there. And on the right side of the page, the front page, are links to all these things, including Eric, Abe's, Mike, Christie's websites, and Eric's podcast, and so forth. And at the bottom of every page of www.darkdiscussions.com are links to the Facebook group Dark Discussions Podcast, as well as the email darkdiscussions@aol.com, Twitter Dark Discussion 1, Stitcher, and the RSS feed. Let's begin with things that people have seen or want to mention that are genre related. And Eric, why don't you start?
All right. Well, I'll start by mentioning that I recently read Chrissy's novel Bad Apple. No. I'll be honest. For most of the book, I was thinking, "Where's this going?" Because it was very descriptive, and I was just following along with the main character. But I got to tell you, Christy, you stuck the landing. Because at the end of the book, I was just like, "Okay, that was totally worth it."
Thank you.
So that was enjoyable. So I've now read your book. Yay!
And oh my gosh, that's cool. I'm so
and Christy, can you find it in Kindle format as well?
Yes.
That's how I read it. Kindle
also, yeah. Oh, okay. So you can find it on Amazon.com.
Yep.
Yep.
And then last weekend I watched a movie with Dan called Z for Zachariah. I know Phil is a huge fan of this movie. I am not as big of a fan of the movie. I thought it was very well acted. But once again, stupid trailer made me think a lot more was going to be going on than was actually going on. It's just pretty much people sitting around talking. So if you're into that, go check it out. If you're expecting action, that's not what you're going to get.
Yeah, Eric, that was it's a science fiction story based off of a novel by, what the hell is the guy's name? Last name's O'Brien. He wrote the Rats of Nim as well. And it's basically a post-apocalypse where three survivors survive in a valley, and it's really more about the human condition, right, than actually, you know, action or anything like that.
It's all about the interaction between the people.
Yes. So if you like quiet films with a little bit of suspense but no action and post-apocalyptic, it's a film for you, and especially if you enjoy the human condition in your genre films.
And it's very well done for what it is.
Fantastic.
It isn't what I was looking for when I went into the movie, so I was a little disappointed. Very, very high level of talent in the movie. It's got Chris Pine and
you're gonna butcher
Margot Robbie. It's Chewy something. I forget his last name.
So
anyway.
But really good
acting. Not much of plot points. and I was really mad when the movie ended because I was like, shit, I knew they were going to end it without anything actually happening.
I guess the book, it basically ends like 2/3 into the book. And I think they decided that would be a good ending because it shows a potential of, it's hard to explain, but.
Well, and also from what I understand, there were only two people in the book, which makes me wonder what they were doing, so.
That's true, yep.
They added another person and didn't finish the book, so what? Huh? Okay. Yep.
but it's on your VOD services for rent at the moment.
Yes. Other things I've been watching, I've been watching some more Supernatural. They only have up through season 9 on Netflix, so I went ahead and bought season 10 on iTunes and started watching that this week. And I've also been watching a show called Blacklist. Have any of you watched that at all?
I have not, no.
Check it out.
People keep recommending it to me, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet.
The first two seasons are on Netflix at this point. I believe they're about to begin broadcasting season three. So yeah, it's totally worth checking out. James Spader is the lead, and he is excellent.
I like him.
Yeah, he's
always good. I haven't
seen anything that he's bad in yet.
And one good thing is he's from New England.
Okay, Phil.
I don't know if I want to brag about that, but okay.
Fair enough.
Oh, dear.
I think that's really all I've watched recently. If I'm forgetting about something, I'll come back around to it later.
Now, before people poo-poo Z for Zachariah, Eric, would you say that
poo-poo.
Would it be similar to, in the same vein, at least the feeling, if completely different plot-wise, as films like Take Shelter or We Need to Talk About Kevin?
I don't think it was as good as those movies that you just named.
Okay, fair enough. Yep.
That's my personal opinion.
I would say it is that type of genre film.
I understand where you're going with that comparison, though.
Yeah, yeah. Or even Red, White, and Blue, for that matter, without the... the excessive violence.
Without the good part.
Yeah.
you know, just to interject here, you know, another movie that was like that, if people like, Eric, if you like watching that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It had, it's not genre. I think it was called A Girl for the End of the World, or it has Kate Winslet and the guy from The Office in it. And it's like the end of the world is coming. They can't stop it. And they kind of, they find love, but the whole, they find love in each other. And they're these really two, like, very opposite people. But it's so, so good.
Oh, what's like, the title of that movie? Something like Searching for a Friend for
Friend at the End of the World or something like that. Yeah. And it's, I would recommend it even though it's not genre, because it is really about what happens when people are sitting around waiting to die. And there's this great scene where he's an insurance agent, and so they know it's coming, but he gets up and goes to work anyway. And he's getting phone calls from people that he's insured, and all you see is him answering, "No, you're not covered for, you know, asteroids, and you're not covered for," and it's like, dude, everybody's gonna die. There's gonna be nothing left. That was just such a great scene. So I do recommend that if you like that type of a story. It's not genre, but definitely check that out. Yeah.
Anything else, Eric?
Nope. I promise I'm done now.
Okay. Before we go to you, Chrissy, I wanted to ask you, did you see the film When Animals Dream, by the way? Because we were talking about that offline.
No, not yet, but I would like to. And I still have to watch Horsehead that I can give
you guys my
assessment.
Explain that shit to us, Christy.
Yeah, I know.
I'll say one thing. Eric was pretty damn good in deciphering what I didn't figure out.
Actually, I thought you guys were all good. I was listening to that episode on my way up to Stacy's house, you know, to come and meet you, Philip, for the Taco Society.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, these guys really, they, I don't know if I'm going to be able to figure this movie out, but I'll try. So I have to watch that. So that's on my list. And When Animals Dream is on my list. I just don't know when I'll get to them, but yeah, I'm definitely going to do it.
Nice. So what have you seen, Chrissy?
Well, not a whole lot, actually. I watched a silly little, postseason is actually starting in our house now. So this is like for the whole month of October where we get all our favorite horror movies out. I have friends over a couple of weekends and we just pound like a bunch of horror movies in a row. So I've kind of laid off watching anything for the last month because I don't want to get horrored out, you know, before, because I do a whole month of it. It's like a whole festival for me. But I did watch this really cute little thing called Bigfootville. It's like an hour-long documentary on Amazon Prime. It's free. And it was just on my watch list that I had put on there a few months ago. And I was like, oh, yeah, what the hell? I'll sit here and watch this. And it actually was kind of entertaining. I really enjoyed it. I watched Back to the Future 3, which I'd never seen. And I'd never seen it. It was fun. I mean, it was fun. There's really no words for it. It's a sequel. It's pretty bad.
Fun.
It was a good time.
That's right.
Yeah. It's fun. I've been catching up on all my podcasts, while I've been driving. Genre-wise, other than that, I've been religiously watching Face Off, which is the creature makeup competition show on the Sci-Fi channel.
I used to love that show.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's like Nathan and I make a point to watch it every week. And I've really been enjoying Fear the Walking Dead. I'm two episodes behind, but I really have been enjoying it. It's very slow. It's different. But the lead female character,
She's awesome.
Kim Dickens, she's amazing.
Oh, Kim Dickens rules.
She's awesome. And like when I saw, I wasn't going to watch the series at all. I was actually like, oh man, really? I don't know. I'm kind of zombied out. I don't really know. And then I saw that she was going to be the female lead. And I was like, oh, I'm so there. Cause I loved her in Tremé. She was my favorite character in Tremé. So I've been enjoying her and I've actually been enjoying the show. It's been kind of interesting. I feel it's got a couple of holes in it that don't quite make sense to me. Like if they're so slow moving and they sort of figure out they can shoot them in the head to kill them, I don't understand. Stand why, I don't know. I just feel like they're not really covering all their bases. But that could be just me. So that's pretty much it. That's really all I've been doing. And the movie we were going to discuss tonight.
All right. What about you, Abe?
Aside from today's topic, the biggest thing I've actually got into was the Frictional Games latest release. Frictional Games is a developer known for two big games they had released. The first was Amnesia series, Amnesia Dark Descent, and the Penumbra series. The best described these games, they're first-person horror stories with a lot of interactivity. You can pick up objects and move around. It allows you to be more immersive with the environment. It's very big on hiding and invading the monsters and enemies in the game. And this is their latest entry that was released actually this Tuesday. For both the PC and the PlayStation 4.
Is it a download or is it a you buy the disc?
Download. Okay. Download, and but it's only $30.
Okay, yep.
Which is a pretty damn good deal, actually, because this is definitely a $30 game. You play some guy named Simon Jarrett who apparently had some horrible bleeding in the brain from an accident. And he's going for the scan to have some scientists who are trying to create some experiments to try to figure out a way to carefully treat brains without actually cutting them open and stuff. They come up with a medical plan by looking at your brains. Okay, what can we do to best treat this brain over and over again without actually putting the brain in any jeopardy? But as soon as they do the scan, it everything goes dark. And you suddenly wake up in this lab deep under the ocean. A research lab called Pathos 2. And everything's been overtaken by this Geiger-esque growth that's spreading throughout the station. And prowling throughout the halls are these horrible, twisted mixes between machine and biomaterial. And it's big on psychological horror and making some really fucked up decisions. Not to mention, tackles a lot of themes of identity and what exactly amounts to what is human. You know, how much of a being counts as human and how much of it can technically remain, memories, thoughts. Does an AI, for example, that can think and feel can be considered human, stuff like that. And it's a very, very, very good game. I love this presentation. It's very intense at times. You cannot fight any of the creatures. You have to evade them, and it can be just heart racing. It's definitely a recommendation. If it was any higher in price, I think I would say for it to go down. But $30 for this is actually pretty good. It plays well on the PS4 for me. But if you have a good, sturdy, gaming computer, I would recommend, your computer. It's out right now, and, I strongly recommend it. It's really interesting. I forgot to say this, the name of the game. It's called Soma. S-O-M-A. Soma. That's all.
Yeah, for me, I don't really have much else to add. Eric mentioned, These Final Hours, which was the one that I was going to mention, had seen. I did rewatch The Den, Eric, and I did rewatch a film called Killer Mermaid. And the reason I watched these films was because when we decided to do this episode, we were choosing a bunch of films from Netflix to decide to do one of the films, and those names had come up as well, and so I just felt like going back and seeing them.
I would like to see Harbinger Down. Did all you guys see that yet?
I saw it as well, actually.
I don't know if we should say our opinions because we, you never know, it may be a film we do in the future, but if Eric or Abe want to give their opinions, they can.
Okay. Oh, no, don't, I'm going to see it either way, so don't. Just because I'm here, don't do it, because I don't want to know until I actually see
it. Yeah, all right.
Okay.
All right, yeah, so let's not do it, because right. And there's always a chance that we may do an episode on it.
I'm really excited about it, because I heard you guys kind of mention it on a show that I listened to recently, and I was like, oh my gosh, I really have to watch that, so maybe I'll do that tomorrow night or something when I'm...
You did mention one other thing I wanted to bring up, Christy, which is... I've never mentioned it, but the Taco Society, and what that is basically... Tony Tremblay, also known as T.T. Zuma, his pen name, lives in the town of Goffstown, New Hampshire, and he created a program called the Taco Society Presents, which basically interviews and discusses horror writing and so forth. And the name came from an idea I had where me, him, and two other local authors, Gardner Goldsmith and Sidney Lee, happened to join him for tacos at a restaurant. And when he brought up to our attention that we could do a show on live cable TV, we said, we'll do it. And he named it the Taco Society Presents. And Christy was a guest, and she discussed her book. She was on for about 20 to 30 minutes, and folks can find all the episodes of the Taco Society Presents on YouTube. Just search for the Taco Society Presents. And we also are on Facebook, the Taco Society Presents. And you can see what me and Chrissy look like in video if you want.
Yes, I love my five chins. I look really awesome. And I love that I can't stop moving my hands. I wanted to go to the screen and tie them together when I watched that. But I had a blast. It was so much fun.
Oh, the worst was when they did the faraway shots. I had my hands in my lap, and it looked and it looked like I was doing something terrible.
What are you doing with those hands, Philip?
Yeah, it's like, oh, good Lord. But what are you gonna do? So,
is it talking about Jason Lloyd?
Very funny. Speaking of Jason Lloyd, Jason Lloyd is of horrorphilia.com and does a number of podcasts, including My Buddy Podcast. And the joke is that whatever Jason Lloyd says is good or bad, I agree usually 100%, or at least that's what Eric says. So
I forget what Eric said on a past episode, but I was listening to it in the car, and I just lost my shit when you said whatever it was you said. It was so funny. I can't remember what it was now, but I was like,
pretty crass. But
it was, it was, yeah, it was awesome.
Terrible. So,
hilarious.
So good. This episode actually will probably be released after a couple of other episodes, but either way, we are recording on September 24th. All right, so I guess we can get into our topic tonight. And Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss?
Tonight, we are going to be discussing a Jim Mickle-directed film, Stakeland.
Call me Martin. I've seen things you wouldn't believe. Things a boy shouldn't see. I was like any other kid. I didn't believe in the boogeyman. Then the world woke up to a nightmare.
Welcome to Stakeland, kid. Get your boots on, your gun's ready. We're gonna put some distance between us and this place.
We're on our own now. Traveling through a ruined land. We live by his rules, or we die. Or worse, we die and we come back.
those things have you killed?
Not enough.
Like Mister says, live free or die trying.
Keep your weapons close and ready.
What are you gonna do?
I'm gonna kill that thing.
Go with God.
Lock the door.
That's right. Stakeland is a Jim Mickle, Nick DiMicci film. The two have been around for a good number of years now, starting with the film Mulberry Street, which was part of the 8 Films to Die For film festival that went around the country a few years ago. Then Stakeland was their second film. Third film was...
We Are What We Are.
Thank you. And then their fourth one was Cold in July. And the fourth one was a Joe R. Lansdale story that they brought to film. Basically, they usually work together. Mickle and DiMicci are basically co-write the films, and Mickle directs. DiMicci did star in as the lead in both Mulberry Street and this one here, Stakeland. However, in the other two films, he had minor parts. My personal opinion, I actually saw their very first film at the film festival, Mulberry Street. That was a treat, and seeing it on the big screen. It's a film that I put into my rotation usually every October to watch as a Halloween film. Mickle and DiMicci, you could argue, are two of the most important filmmakers in genre, or at least independent genre today. Along with folks like Simon Barrett and Adam Wingard and a few others. The interesting film about Stakeland, it was produced by Larry Fessenden, who is a director himself, and he actually was in We Are Still Here. He played the guy that did the seance.
Oh, okay.
And he produced this film. He actually, basically the film was written by Nick DiMicci, mostly. And then, you know, Mickle came on and you know, filled out some of the stuff. And he was going to make it, DiMicci was going to make it as a web series, I guess, even though they had already done Mulberry Street. And Fassenden thought it was such a great script that he said, no, let's make this into a motion picture and get it out to the festival circuits. To be honest, it's probably a good thing because, their last film, Cold in the July, had some major stars in it. Don Johnson and, the
Michael
dude that
C.
played.
Hall.
Yeah, there you go. This is a film from 2010. It's, again, their second film, Jim Mickle and Nick DiMicci. This is oddly our first time ever doing a, Mickle DiMicci film on this podcast, even though they've been around pretty much since the podcast started and have, as I stated, one of the more important directors in the past 5 years. So.
Mentioned Mulberry Street and Stakeland in passing several times.
Yes, yes, we have. I actually think I had Stakeland as in my top 10 from 2012 horror list back when the podcast was in its infancy.
And you and Mike, I think, had a – did you guys do a vampire episode back in the day?
Oh, yeah, yeah, way back.
I think you talked – you mentioned it briefly during that episode as well.
I think you're absolutely right. I think we did. So as I stated, the film stars Nick DiMicci as the lead. There's also a guy named Connor Paolo, or I should say a young adult. That's his name. Also has Daniel –
Hey, Phil, what's his nationality? We all want to know.
I have absolutely no idea. I'm assuming.
I got you.
I'm assuming it's Italian, but who knows, you know?
Whatever it is, it's something hyphen American.
That's right. That's right. His mother's maiden name was Mendelssohn, so that's German. Then it also stars Danielle Harris, who everybody knows from numerous horror films, and Kelly McGillis. From the Tom Cruise days, she's in this as well.
Yeah, that was a... Yeah, she doesn't look like Top Gun anymore.
Yeah, I kept going, oh my God, like, really?
That's true. And this is and then a guy named Sean Nelson is also a star in this. And this is Kelly McGillis's first film in like 10 years, I believe. So she had retired, semi-retired or basically retired. And then I think this is basically her first major role or any role for that matter in like 10 years. So, yeah, she changed a little bit.
I just couldn't believe that was the same Kelly McGillis, like, you know, kind of airhead, like that she, because I just thought, we'll talk about this later, but I thought she was really good. And I'm like, that can't be the same Kelly McGillis. This girl is actually really good. Like, she's a great actress. Well, what happened?
The first time I watched this movie, I was like 3/4 of the way of the movie, I was like, I could have sworn Kelly McGillis was supposed to be in this. I like looked it up on my iPad while I was watching the movie, and I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah, hopefully. I give her credit, man. She was really amazing. Like, I hope that she does other movies, because I'd like to see what other things she does, you know?
She did one other. She did another genre film, I think the same year or the year after, that's entitled The Innskeepers, which was filmed in Connecticut.
Yes. Actually... To interject, next Saturday, October 3rd, I am going up to the Warner Theater because my housemate Charles is playing in the Pitt Orchestra for a musical called Assassins. And it's basically a musical, but all of the famous assassins, you kind of find out what in the world, like Lee Harvey Oswald and John Wilkes Booth. And it's a show where they all – it's kind of like a confessional musical. It's an odd one. Not a lot of people do it, but I'm really excited to go see it. But my point is the Warner Theater is right across the street from the Yankee Peddler Inn where the Innkeepers was filmed. So I've actually been up because my housemate does a lot of shows there and I do go see musicals there frequently. I've been at that location many, many times. So
cool.
That's the only reason why I really actually like the Innkeepers. Because it really is shot on location, and if you've really been inside that inn, which I have, that is really what it looks like. And to me, that's the win. I don't care about the rest of the movie. I just like seeing some place I've actually been. So.
And what town is that in?
It is in Torrington, Connecticut.
And where is Torrington, Connecticut?
In relation to me, it's about an hour... I would say maybe northeast a little bit. It's like straight up Route 8. So you would drive from Danbury, which I'm down, you know, kind of by the New York border. You'd drive, I'm about an hour north of New York City, in case anybody's wondering. Then you go about half an hour to Waterbury, and then you cut over on Route 8, and you go about another 30 minutes. And that cuts through a very kind of what they call the valley. It's sort of a desolate area of Connecticut that sadly, when all of the manufacturing moved out of the area, those towns really kind of died. And Torrington has really been a struggling city in terms of coming back. It's kind of Derby or Shelton. There's been a lot of abandoned storefronts and, you know, old factories and just stuff that's really kind of broken down. And Torrington, because of things like the Warner Theater, is beginning to come back. So.
Very good. Now, let's see here. All right, let's discuss how we discovered this film and what we thought of it. So, Eric, why don't you start?
I believe I heard about this film listening to the Horror Etc. podcast back in the day. And Ted was speaking highly of it. And he's usually much more highly critical of movies than Tony is. So when he recommends something, I'm usually inclined to go check it out. So I did, and I found it to be the perfect anti-Twilight. Cause that was right around the time where the Twilight fever was just rampaging across the nation. And I found this a refreshing change of pace. So I really enjoyed it, for what it is. It is a bleak, dark movie, with animalistic vampires. And I like it a lot.
All right, very good. Once again, I had seen Mikkel and DiMichi's film Mulberry Street at the theaters during the Eight Films to Die For festival a couple of years prior to this film, and that film by far was the best in the bunch, to the point where I said, you know, this is a film I could watch over and over and over again. And so as I usually do when I like a film, I always look up the director and screenwriters, and I always put them on my list of checking out films of theirs when they come out with new stuff. And Stakeland was one of them that suddenly popped up, and I started following it on the internet as it was, you know, getting ready to be released. And so when it got released, I picked up the Blu-ray, and that's how I got it. So I had already, I was pretty well versed in the film for that fact alone. And yeah, at the time seeing it, I thought it was a fantastic film. Mikkel and DiMichi, I thought, were huge and up and coming in genre, and they actually are still. They're still doing fantastic work. I rewatched the film two nights ago, and interesting how it is. I forgot that it was like a quote unquote coming of age film, and some of the interesting things that we'll talk about as we discuss the film. I don't know if I think this is as good as I originally thought it was based off of some of the things, because, you know, now I see some of the I guess I don't want to use the word, but I'll have to say, because I can't think of anything else, corniness of the coming of the age and various naming conventions of New Eden and things like that, when I would think people would still just say Ontario. They wouldn't say New Eden, it renamed things, but you know, these are, you know, nitpicks, minor crapola things, so no big deal. But
so you're standing in for Mike tonight.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. I didn't really consider it the anti-Twilight like Eric did, because at that time I had not bothered seeing any of the Twilight films, so I didn't even know what really people were talking about. And I did like this type of vampire, though my favorite vampire is the one that is like the original Dracula from the book Bram Stoker's Dracula, where
a romantic vampire.
Well, no, he's not even romantic. He's more of a demon. I mean, he's human like, but he's a demon in the sense that he's an enemy of the Catholic and Episcopal Church and all that type of thing. So it's a war between evil and good, rather than animalistic vampires. So my favorite vampire is that. So I'm not even talking about the romanticized Dracula that has happened in the films in the past 40 years.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a fantastic vampire film, and it came out basically during the middle, not only the Twilight vampires, but in the middle of the zombie apocalypse. And so the film, you could argue, feels very similar to a zombie or a 28 Days Later type film.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because of how they made it almost like a virus apocalypse type thing. Instead of zombies, they just made them quote unquote vampires. I don't even know if they even use the term vampire in the film, do they?
I don't think they say it out loud, no.
No, they say vamps.
They do? Okay.
They refer to them as vamps, and the kid ones are scamps.
Yeah, that's right.
But I don't think they ever use the word vampire.
No, there's always like those short little nicknames, berserkers.
Yeah, it's berserkers, vamps, but vamps is definitely one. Yeah, because like there's that scene where he's holding open the map and it says vamped on it.
Oh yeah,
So
yeah,
but it's like those zombie movies where no one's supposed to say zombie for some reason.
Right. Yeah, like The Walking Dead. They say walkers. They've never used the word zombie, which I don't understand why. So, Abe, what about you? Where did you hear about this film? Where did you hear about this film, and what's your opinion of it?
I first saw a trailer for this movie, I think, online. I think it was a horror channel on YouTube that I was showing, like, showcasing different upcoming horror flicks. And I was like thinking, hey, this looks pretty interesting. And But because of other things I had to take care of, I haven't watched it till actually very recently. In fact, by the time we started this recording, I had actually just finished the movie. It's my first time actually watching it. So a fresh set of eyes on this flick. And I have to say, I really like it. I always loved the more ghoulish vampires. I always liked those horrible, nightmarish creatures that just stalk in the dark. I've grown so tired of the romanticized or the pretty boy vampires of just seeing piles of them in the media. So it was very refreshing to see just them as these terrifying zombie-like abominations. And, you know, the title at first, you know, if I hadn't seen the trailer, I would have thought it was like a vampire spinoff of Zombieland or something. But I was thank God it was actually straight up horror film. I thought that it was very straightforward. Like, there wasn't any really complex twists or anything like that. Characters were kind of like, you got an idea who they were, but they weren't also that overly complex. But as I think someone mentioned, it was like a coming-of-age story, and it did play off that way because a great deal of the story is told through narration by the young man, Martin, who kind of matures as he grows accustomed to the new setting. And I thought that was really cool. Overall, I really liked the movie. I thought it was really well made. And more ways than one, acting, production, makeup, just an overall solid vampire flick.
And Abe, you first saw this film this week, right? Or in the past week and a half?
Tonight, actually.
Yeah, there you go. Very good. So it's fresh in your mind. Because some of these older films that you haven't seen, like Drag Me to Hell and Stakeland, have been brought to your, I guess, your top of your queue because of this podcast, basically, right?
And it's actually been great because I've always been meaning to watch them, but never got the opportunity.
Very good. Now, Chrissy, what about yourself? I was curious... when we were discussing online about a week ago about you coming on, I was thinking that you may not want to come on for the fact that I don't know if this is your type of film necessarily.
That is exactly so right. That was why I Facebooked you yesterday and said, I'll get back to you. So I'd never heard of this movie, and I go on Amazon Prime and I'm like, okay, let me read some of the reviews. Let me just see what this is about. Cause I really can't stand vampire things. I'm not a vampire person. I don't enjoy them. I really enjoyed Interview with the Vampire, and I think that movie just kind of was it for me. After that, I was kind of done. Of course I liked Dracula and other things like that, but I was just sort of vamped out. And then of course I have this problem where my husband and my housemate love From Dusk Till Dawn, and it's like always on all the time. And I'm just I just don't find that movie appealing to me. I know it's a wonderful movie, but it just doesn't turn me on. So I go and I'm looking on Amazon after I talk to Phil, and they're describing it like, this is a really cool movie. It's kind of like From Dusk Till Dawn meets 30 Days of Night. And I was like, oh, Jesus, God, I don't know if I really want to waste an hour and 45 minutes of my life on another From Dusk Till Dawn type thing. But then I started reading around, and there were some other reviews that said this is really more of a drama. The setting is beautiful. It's, you know, stuff that kind of made me think that, well, maybe I should check it out. And then I saw that there was a trailer. So I watched the trailer and I went, oh my God, this movie looks actually like it's up my alley. So that's when I decided I was going to come on and watch it. Cause it didn't look like, I think the people who were describing it as From Dusk Till Dawn meets 30 Days of Night really did not understand it, because that's not what it was to me at all.
If I could interject for a second, I could see the 30 Days of Night comparison, but yeah, Still Dawn, I don't see that at all.
Yeah, I don't know if it was maybe because the characters were kind of, some of them were kind of badass, or I don't know what the association was there. So I watched it and I was very pleasantly surprised. I found it a little heavy-handed, kind of both Phil and Abe alluded to. There were some things where it was just a little bit overdone, but I think if you're going to try to reach certain audiences that you almost have to do that because it's almost too subtle. Like I almost got the sense that they were trying to target this for a younger teen audience that kind of really would miss a lot of things if they weren't beaten over the head with it. Not necessarily because they're stupid, but just because they don't have the life experience yet. They haven't gone to, you know, through all of high school to get all those illusions and things pounded into them yet.
Right.
So I think that's the, I think that's more what they were going for. And I think that's why some of it was so obvious.
Yeah, it was on the nose with a bunch of its stuff.
Yeah, it was on the nose with a lot of things. Like New Eden was very obvious, like Phil mentioned. There's a scene there that I'll discuss with the Mary and the Joseph. I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Really? Like, that's, let me take these statues out and put them on the hood. Like, oh, okay. Oh, I get it now. Like, you know, but other than that, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I was really pleasantly surprised. I loved the atmosphere. I loved the score. What a unique musical score for this type of vampire type of film. I mean, it was beautiful. I would like to buy the soundtrack. Actually, you can buy the soundtrack. So I think I'm going to buy it. You can get it on iTunes. I mean, it was beautiful. I would put that on in the background at a party or a dinner party I was having. So it's just a very sad, mournful. A lot of it is just piano. It's really beautiful.
The music is by a guy named Jeff Grace.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was great. I almost enjoyed that as almost more than I enjoyed the movie. The score was so awesome. But I'm a movie soundtrack person. I'm a score person. So that's my opinion. I found it really good. I don't know that I would watch it again, but I did really enjoy it, and I was pleasantly surprised, and I was kind of glad that Phil was like, well, you know, I just felt bad because I'm like, Phil is going to see right through why I'm telling him to wait.
Yeah.
And of course you did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, a couple of further things about the background of the film, just to add it here. We forgot to mention Michael Cerveris. He is also a star of this film, probably most known for genre fans for The Observer and the television show Fringe.
Okay.
Yes. And he's in this film as well. Cerveris, that's a Lithuanian last name, however, I bring it up only because there's a running joke on Twitter with him where people always think he's Greek because the last name can be sound Greek sounding as well. And he always says, nope, not Greek, but everybody thinks I'm Lithuanian. And he's not even Lithuanian except very long, distant. So it's just an interesting thing if you follow him on Facebook. Twitter. Roger Ebert rated the film 3 out of 4 stars, and it did get 75% good, fresh ratings on Rotten Tomato out of, at least the time of this post, 60 reviews. So that's not bad. And every film that these two guys have done have had 70% or better reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. Eric, so why don't we give that synopsis of the film, or basically what an IMDb or a wiki or whatever I would say about it.
Let's see. I got IMDb actually has 2 here. I'll go with the shorter one. Martin was a normal teenage boy before the country collapsed in an empty pit of economic and political disaster. A vampire epidemic has swept across what is left of the nation's abandoned towns and cities. It's up to Mr., a death-dealing rogue vampire hunter, to get Martin safely north to Canada, the continent's New Eden.
That's right. Basically, a couple other things about the film, or explanation. It's basically As we discussed, a post-apocalyptic film, as Eric just described in the IMDb wiki blurb. The land of Canada, or at least part of Canada anyway, is called, quote-unquote, the New Eden, or a place that's free of vampires, because vampires are supposedly, or the virus anyway, is supposedly not able to survive in colder climates. Throughout the country, there have been groups of religious crazies that have formed, believing that this apocalypse was created by God to punish the evil of man.
Punish!
And as Eric stated, basically a group of survivors trying to get to Canada. The interesting thing is, though, is that there's hundreds of survivors. So this isn't like The Walking Dead, where there's only little teeny pockets of survivors. Survivors are equally around as the vampires themselves, and the vampires only come out at night. So during the day, you are safe. I thought that was an interesting thing, where even though there's an epidemic of vampires, the people still have been able to create various towns, and they're very common. They're not rare like in other apocalyptic type stories. All right, so what do we want to discuss? Why don't we discuss the very first scene and the narration, because the first scene, I remember when the film first came out, it was huge on the internet and blogs about what happened, because as we always state, you don't kill dogs and you don't kill babies in movies. And yeah, and this film breaks one of the two in basically the first scene. However, before we get into that first scene, Chrissy, why don't you talk about the narration, because as we were discussing, it may be a little heavy-handed. When I first saw the film, it didn't appear that way to me, but rewatching it two nights ago, I was shocked how heavy-handed it was.
Well, Call Me Martin is, of course, an allusion to the opening line of Moby Dick's, you know, the opening line of Moby Dick, Call Me Ishmael.
Yeah.
And we do see throughout the film that the Mr. character is almost like a Captain Ahab in those first moments, because Martin says, oh, we live by his rules. And because we go into the film thinking, oh, he's a vampire hunter, we almost get this Captain Ahab kind of feel about him. But there's something interesting that happens with that later, because we figure out that the white whale that we think that he's chasing is really not the white whale that he's chasing at all. And that was one of the things that I thought was more subtle about the movie. But we see, with flashback, people are being evacuated. And also, I did want to mention, too, that when we go into this flashback, if you know anything about Moby Dick, I kind of went off on a Moby Dick thing from that first scene. And this movie does carry the four major Moby Dick themes. There's a ton of themes in Moby Dick, but there's like four major ones. One of them is duty, you know, the sense of doing your duty.
Duty.
Yeah, duty, like, you know, whatever. Another one is friendship. What's another one? Defiance, although defiance really wasn't a big one in this film. And of course, obviously death is another big one in Moby Dick, but I don't think this film dealt as much with death or defiance. I think it was really, its two main themes, if I had to say, put forth, would be duty and friendship. Those were the two big themes that I would nail. So I was kind of going nuts, not only looking for the religious symbolism in this film, because I thought it was the religious symbolism that was a little more heavy-handed than the Moby Dick thing. And I don't even know if anybody else, except for that opening thing, would really compare it to Moby Dick. It's just that that's one of my favorite books. And so I was really going nuts, like, looking for stuff.
No, I did not pick up on the Moby Dick thing.
Abe, what about you?
No, I really didn't catch any of that either, really. I mean, I must have completely missed that.
Well, Moby Dick is kind of like, it's got a lot going on with it, but it is sort of a coming of age story, even though Ishmael is not really a young man at the beginning of the book.
No.
He has a lot of growth to go on. It's a big journey book, and he learns a lot about himself.
Yeah.
And so Martin kind of is the Ishmael, because he's learning all these new skills, like Ishmael had to learn about, you know, whaling. This kid has to learn about killing vampires. So there's a lot of similarities there. But, you know, even Eric, you just said you just got done reading Bad Apple. I mean, opening a book with a line like, call me Martin, or let me tell you what my name is, or whatever. I do it in Bad Apple, too. It's a very famous device, and it's not even cliched. It's just that if you want a certain effect, or if you want to set up a certain type of story, it's a really good way to go. And so that's why I don't even remember the opening line of my book, but it's not call me Scarborough, but it's something like Scarborough, that's my name, or something like that. So I just was really drawn to that immediately. And that's what sucked me in immediately. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be a Moby Dick story. I have to look for everything in Moby Dick. But also, Abe, what you were saying, and then we'll move on. All of the characters that he meets along the way are archetypes. You know, you were saying the characters,
yeah,
I forget.
They're very simplistic.
They are, because they're archetypes. I mean, you have the warrior. Mister is the warrior.
Yep.
Peggy at the end is the maiden. The sister is the crone. And that's not a mean labeling. It's just that's an archetype. Martin is the knight. Belle is the mother. And the marine that they find, or the guy who, you know, the guy who gives them all the information about how Washington fell and all that, he's the messenger. So, and I'm sure there's more. If I look at all the different characters, I would find the other archetypes, but they're in there. So that's probably why you were sensing that the characters were really simplistic, because they kind of are. They're archetypes. And they're archetypes for a reason, because they're supposed to be like, okay, here's the end of the world. We all become the everyman. We all essentially play an archetypal role. But anyway, I'll shut up now, because we haven't even started the movie yet, and I'm going
with it. I was just going to say that I personally appreciate the heavy-handedness when it comes to religious symbolism, because I did grow up with any type of religion in my life. I've never gone to church. It's just not part of my life. So in order for me to get it, I kind of had needed to be heavy-handed, so I didn't really pick up on it as such until my second viewing of the movie. Because the first time I was just like, "Oh yeah, that's the thing." So
now, Chrissy mentioned Mister. Mister is the character played by Nick DiMicci, and he is never named, and he is a vampire hunter. But he's a vampire hunter in the sense that he's out to kill the plague or get revenge on this plague that probably did something to maybe someone he loved in the past. He's more of a Mad Max type of character than a, you know, Van Helsing or Jonathan Harker type. So when we say vampire hunter, we mean more like The Man with No Name from Clint Eastwood, maybe, films, something like that, rather than anything else. At least that's how I interpreted the character. For the boy, his whole family gets wiped out, and this guy, Mister, saves him, and that is basically the first person to create this little group that's going to become like a new family, in a sense. So the boy and Mister are family. And then, as we discussed, there's other characters like the mother, which is a nun, and the marine, and then Danielle Harris's character, who's pregnant, and a few other folks that join into this quote-unquote new family. Which was an interesting thing, I thought.
Right, but there is a key moment in that opening flashback where they're getting ready. I love how they use the radio also to kind of sort of narrate what's happening. Did anybody else?
And that's been done before in zombie movies, but it was an appropriate use of the.
It was very appropriate here because it wasn't wasted. They were filling in little pieces of the story that you needed to know without having like a, as you know, Bob, the zombies came in and did this. Like you just got a little piece of it here, which was good.
Or giant exposition dump.
Right, exactly. So I thought that was well done. And I also liked that they used the newspapers that they found along the way to kind of fill in the backstory and also tell you where they were, you know, on their journey north. But there's a key moment there, Phil, that I want to mention, and that is the father, Martin's father, is there dying, and he's the one who says to Mister, what does he say? Take care of my boy or something like that.
Yeah, or and, bring my boy to safety or something like that.
Right, and that becomes basically what I was saying later, Mister's white whale. Mister's white whale, we think in the opening he's chasing vampires, but he's not. He then accepts duty, a sense of duty from the father, and that's his white whale because that's what he's chasing. He's trying to get Martin home. He's trying to fulfill that sense of duty. Kind of like Starbuck in Moby Dick.
If we could bring into that really good scene, basically what happens is the family is planning to pack up and leave to safety, I guess, quote unquote, New Eden, I guess, which is Canada, basically. And so they're working on the car or something to do so. And what happens is that the vampires attack, kill the mother, kill the baby sibling. I don't know. We don't know if it's a boy or a girl. I forget. And then the father lays dying, and Mister comes by. He's just happened to be out and about. Saves the boy, kills the vampire that wipes out his family. And the one interesting thing about that whole scene, besides the death of the baby, because, again, that was a big thing because it was like one of the first more recent horror films that killed a baby in a film, was the when the father asks for help to, you know, for, you know, you save my boy and bring him to safety and the duty and all that, Mister doesn't say, I will do so, you know, like you would see in other films. He just kills the father, and that's it. And I thought that was interesting because he didn't give any reassurance to the father before the father was put out of his misery. But again, that I thought that was cool as well because no matter whether you give reassurance or you say, fuck you, the moment that he's dead, he's dead. So it doesn't even matter what was in his brain when he dies anyway because when you're dead, you're dead.
So, right, and the baby crying is also a three beat because the baby's crying at the beginning and that's basically, it's a symbol of Martin about to be born again because this is about Martin becoming a man. Then there's baby crying the second time when they go to the camp, you know, when all the crazies stand up or whatever. We'll talk about that
trap.
Later.
Yeah, yeah.
The trap, yep.
And
then Martin's at a specific time and a specific point in his development. I'd have to look at my notes when that second baby cries. And then, of course, the third time is when it's dead at the end. When Belle's unborn baby, you never hear the baby cry. And right after that is when he really becomes a man. So it's just interesting. It's an interesting three beat that they do there. And the whole movie, I'm sitting here and I'm listening to the baby cry the couple times that I'm going, that means something. And I'm not sure what it means. I didn't figure it out till the end, but yeah. So
and then
anyway.
She started piling mashed potatoes on her plate higher and higher. This means something.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to go throw some bricks and shit through my kitchen window right now.
And you know what's funny is that most cases I would basically say to you, Christy, that you're full of shit and that my ass, that, where do you read all this crap? But because it's Jim Mickle and Nick DiMicci, it wouldn't surprise me if all these things from Moby Dick to the three beats with the baby and things like that, that I personally didn't notice in this film, but I could see all that intentionally put in. And not just, you know, criticism that as people see themselves. I could actually see it was intentionally put in because of who the filmmakers are for this.
Well, yeah. And sometimes, you know, it's like a baby crying is just a baby crying. But the way that it was placed in the action, I was kind of like, there's something going on with this, and I just need to see if I can figure out what it is. That doesn't mean I'm right. That's the fun of criticism. The fun of literary criticism, of film criticism, is that no one's ever really wrong. It's how you perceive it. Somebody could look at that baby and get anything else out of that. And that's what makes for really interesting discussion. A crying baby also means lost innocence. And I mean, if there's anything that makes you lose your innocence, it's your whole family being killed in front of you.
You think?
Yeah. So, you know, it could be a number of things. It's just, it's kind of fun when you start really kind of digging around that you can make these associations, because that's what always makes it fun, at least for me. So.
Eric, what was your thoughts of this first, I guess, 10 to 15 minutes? We mentioned the radio as exposition was a brilliant way to get exposition without doing the exposition dump that Abe mentioned. We mentioned the baby's death and how that was shocking for the time that this film came out in 2010. We discussed the Moby Dick thing that Christy noticed, as well as various other parts just of this scene, from Mr. being like a Mad Max or a man with no name. Give me your thoughts.
Well, the first time I saw the opening to this movie, my initial thoughts were, holy shit.
Indeed.
That's basically what it came down to, because it had been quite some time since I saw a vampire movie with any punch to it. So I was really not expecting that going into it. And then the sheer brutality of that opening scene, along with the fact that they off the baby, I was just like, whoa, I have no idea what's going to happen next. And that's awesome.
Now, Abe, what about you? You actually mentioned the exposition thing, dump, and how they didn't do that and stuff. But besides that, or if you wanted to add to that, what other things did you have to say about this first 15 minutes? Because this is really sets up the whole film and what we get.
Oh, yeah, and I thought it was done really well, because you could end up spending way too much time doing a lot of world building. But they did just enough so you understood how things kind of worked. And just who our main characters are, and basically idea how the relationship is, was pretty much just like a teacher and an apprentice. At the same time, almost like a surrogate father figure. You get the idea that Mr. is a guy who's a very stoic, very quiet man, who's more about action, and he expresses himself in very small ways, but you get an idea. You get a nice sense of his humanity, little by little, as we go along. There, you know, he's got a heart there. It's just buried under a lot of a very cynical mask. It's not surprising considering the world that they're now have to fight in day in and day out.
That's true. That's true, and. The mystery of the character. It was just a well drawn character from various aspects. Now, where do we want to go next? What happens next? Because Eric, you or maybe it was you, Chrissy, that mentioned the second baby scene. That was a quote unquote fake out. But was there any other items in between, I guess, those two scenes that we wanted to discuss?
We got to discuss when they meet sister.
Yeah, no. There kind of is. Because, at the end of that scene, and I'm sorry, I know it was supposed to be like Mr. showing the kid how to fight, but it just reminded me of scenes out of the Karate Kid.
Wait for the
I was like, oh my God, it's Mr. Miyagi. Excellent.
Mr. Miyagi, vampire slayer.
I know, it's just so funny. I couldn't even get past that. Once that got into my head, every time they did that, I would just laugh because it was just funny. But the next scene, it's daylight, and we discover that they're headed north, which is also kind of symbolistic, because if you think you're true north, you know, humanity has gone to shit. And when your life goes to shit, people always say, find your true north. So that was kind of symbolistic also. And we clearly see that they're heading north. Now, I didn't check to see where this was filmed, but I suspect it was on location, because when the movie opens, we already get the sense that they've come up from the South, but they're in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, which is right near where Blobfest is.
It was filmed in Pennsylvania,
I pass that
New York.
Exit all the time. Yeah. Okay. So they did film it on location. Cause I know there's a scene where they're like, you see the road sign and it says 17B. And 17B, that highway only exists in Sullivan County, New York, which is like around Woodstock and Saugerties and that area.
The two locations they list on IMDb are Pottstown, Pennsylvania and Middletown, New York.
Yep. That would make sense. Absolutely. So the next scene, it's daylight. We discovered that they're headed north to this place called New Eden. And they stop over at one of these towns that Philip had mentioned. Oh, and I kind of wanted your guys' opinion on this. When they saw the badasses coming toward the car and they're checking them out, was anybody else just relieved that they were cool at the end of that? Like, I was like, oh, God, here we go with the Walking Dead badass. Everybody's right? A badass. Everybody wants to get out of here, you know? Uh-huh. And it was nice that they actually found a town that was just shelter, and it was nice, and they let them in, and it was no big deal.
Right.
But yeah. I thought they were going to get locked up or something. I thought they were going to get all the weapons confiscated, locked in, they got to prove themselves to some bullshit or something like that. But, you know, all the shows, like, they were actual, I think it's actually when they see the teeth that they knew they were okay.
Oh, yeah. And they were okay. And, oh, I love the weird guy in the grocery store.
Before we continue, what Abe is referring to is that Mr. carries with him fang teeth from vampires that he's killed, and they use them as a number of things, from money to, as Abe just said, to show that they're, you know, good people because they're fighting the vampires.
Mm-hmm. And that's weird. The currency part is what's really I found weird, because, I mean, aside from just like, yeah, look at me, I actually killed some fucking vampires, it's not very practical to trade with someone for, you know?
Oh,
what are you talking about? There are a bunch of uses for unattached vampire teeth.
Wait a minute. I think I just figured it out. Because don't the psycho Christian, the whatever they call them, they believe that the vampires are minions of God, so they wouldn't kill the vampires? So the reason he's showing the teeth is to show that he's not one of those Christian crazy people.
Okay.
Holy crap, I just figured that out just now.
But
yeah.
It doesn't explain why people trade teeth for guns and ammo and stuff.
Well, what else are you going to trade? Money's no good.
I don't know. I would think trading one type of weapon for another type of weapon or some ammo would make more sense than, like, here's some teeth, give me that revolver.
Yeah, but you know what, Abe? Handing people pieces of paper and little circular metal, or a card that you slide in a machine, you kind of can say, what's that worth in real life, too? You know what I'm saying?
Besides, I have done some seriously orgasmic things with random teeth. You have no idea.
I have nothing to respond to with that. It's like, wow.
Jesus, God damn it. I don't even want to know.
Sorry.
I don't want to know.
No, but I think Phil is right. That was my point, is that I think it's just as valid as money or anything else. I mean, if money's no good because you can't use it, what are you going to use to trade? Although, don't they trade something else, like tobacco or something?
I was
going to
say, I was kind of with Abe, where I would have thought they'd fall back on the barter system, but that's just me.
Well, they do trade, yeah, because when they go in the bar, he's like, oh, I got some antibiotics and I got something else. Anybody else remember that scene?
Speaking of the bar, yes, I do. The guy that played the bartender is Larry Fassender, the producer. The same guy that was in We Are Still There.
Okay.
As a matter of fact. Now, someone was mentioning something about a shopkeeper.
Oh, yeah, the weird guy in the store. And he's like, oh, he's really a hunter? And that was also kind of a Moby Dick reference, because everybody's kind of heard of this guy or heard about this guy or heard – it sort of seemed like they sort of knew of him.
I think Mister's got a rep of some sort.
Yeah, and that was kind of a cool thing because, of course, everybody knew Captain Ahab, that he was trouble in Moby Dick. Everybody knew it. So I thought that was kind of neat. But Yeah, but the storekeeper just really cracked me up because he was just so weird. He's like, wow, he's a hunter. Like,
yeah, that guy was creepy.
All right. So,
is he the one who says that it's full of cannibals, or is that later? New Eden.
Yeah, I forget where that piece of information comes from.
Okay. Is he the one who says that?
The store clerk says it. Yeah, the store clerk's like, you shouldn't go up there. There's a bunch of cannibals up there. There's nothing up there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Right. And that's the thing, is that Canada, or the heavy handedness of calling it New Eden, which I would not believe it would suddenly be called New Eden. They would just call it, Canada or Ontario. It's safe up there. But either way, it's only a dream. In other words, they don't know if Canada is really a safe haven. They don't know if there's cannibals up there. They don't know if it's harmony and the virus actually can't survive up there. They don't know. And you know, you could even argue that Pennsylvania and New York, the temperament of the, or temperature or the, or whatever, is the same as Ontario anyway. So, you know, I mean, it's what it is that these people in this world, meaning Mr. and his group of quote-unquote family, are using New Eden as a goal and as a symbol of hope rather than anything else, because they don't really know if anything is actually going to be up there anyway.
Right.
Now, where else do we want to talk about? Is there any other items here? This is basically where we learn about the religious crazies too, I think, right?
Well, I think Eric wanted to talk about Sister and how they met. So, Eric, yeah, you should talk about that, because they leave the town, and then I think this is where they
And it's huge, not just because they meet one of the quote-unquote family, but also because how they meet it directly affects and creates the antagonist of the film because of it. But Eric, why don't you go ahead and explain all this?
Oh, basically, they're driving down the road, and they spot this woman running away from a couple of guys chasing her.
What is she dressed in, Eric?
Clothes.
A nun's habit.
Is she wearing a full-out habit?
She is.
What's left of it? It's torn and wrecked.
Okay, I guess I didn't recognize it as a habit.
Gotcha.
So she's running away from two guys who are chasing her, and Mister stops the car and gets out, and clearly these guys are trying to rape this woman, and Mister doesn't think that's very cool. So he takes care of the situation, basically slits the one guy's throat, and then
he throws like a boomerang steak.
I think what he had there was actually one of the cross car jacks that he had sharpened on
ends.
And he throws it with precise accuracy to catch the other guy running away in the back.
What was it, a jack or was it a one of those things, that the nut things that takes off the nuts?
That's what I meant.
Yeah, crowbar.
I don't know what you call that, though. It's not a crowbar, though.
No.
Because it's one of the ones that's a, you know, it's a T. Yeah. I don't know what the name for it is.
Right.
Listeners, help us out. Write in. Tell us what that thing is called.
That's right. Or write it on Facebook.
It was like a really awesome star with teeth, and I wish I had one of those at work.
You and your teeth! Jeez!
Oh, it would be pretty awesome to have one around.
Wouldn't it? Like, oh my God, you just pissed me off. Whap.
Whoosh. Yep. So Mister takes care of the would-be rapists and takes in Sister, and we find out that she's a nun and very religious. And she pretty much starts tagging along. And we come to find out later that the guy that he stabbed in the back with the awesome weapon of whatever it's called was actually a key relation to somebody else in the movie later.
Now, let's talk about an interesting thing. After they nurse her back to health, in a sense, she says, you didn't have to kill these people. Because it's curious what happens is he doesn't even ask or stop or communicate with the people that are the bad guys that are trying to, I guess, attack and rape the sister. What he does is he just kills them. But doesn't even think twice. It was like second nature to him. And she says that they were humans and we probably shouldn't have killed them. And he says, to me, rapists don't deserve any justice. Now, what's your guys' opinion of this? Because obviously they're trying to show the religious side and the other side is. But this film, you could argue, is very negative on religion and not specifically with Sister, but with these other religious crazies we're going to meet soon anyway. But it also is kind of trying to take the moral center, which is, you could argue, is the sister who's saying, forgive the people who are trying to do horrible things to me, rape me, and probably even kill me, versus justice in an apocalyptic world where Mister says, no, I just kill them because they're you know, sociopaths, whatever, they're waste.
Well, the first words that she says to him, though, right when they're still on the roadside, is, they told me they were Christian. That's the first thing she says.
Okay, so that's another thing that you could argue is, yeah, it's a heavy hand in this.
Or they claimed they were Christian. I think like that. And
they were Christian because we find out that they're part of the religious crazy.
Well, and that's the definition of Christian in this film anyway.
Yeah,
which is also interesting because later when that trap is set up, yes, you see all of them and they're laying there with the paper cups, which is a reference to Jonestown.
That
was actually one of the more subtle references in the film, but I thought that was really cool. Interesting
because I had forgotten that scene when I watched it a second time. And so when it came out again, I thought that there were like really all these people here who had off themselves by drinking the Kool-Aid.
That's what I thought too. Yeah.
There's a baby sitting there and I was like, oh my God, this is horrible.
Surprise.
Turns out to be a different kind of horrible.
Well, but I think to get back to Phil's question, I mean, this really goes kind of into very deep sort of, I don't know whether you'd call it philosophical or moral or maybe not even necessarily religious. But
that's true. Yeah.
I think there are some people that, let's just say for an apocalyptic circumstance, everybody kind of becomes, there's a whole Lord of the Flies sort of theme going on with this too, in that we all kind of become animals if there is no civilization. Like, and the overwhelming comment of Lord of the Flies or theme or whatever is that when there is no organized civilization, we all become animals. Right. We lose our sense of politeness, of respecting rules, of whatever that is. And so I think this movie had something to say about that too, but in an apocalyptic world, when everybody just kind of melts down and once again just becomes the animals that they are, because there is no law to control them, because there is no Island of Dr. Moreau dealt with this too. There's a lot of books that deal with this same type of issue. You know, you have to wonder. I mean, here are these guys that are just going around raping because they can. There's no control. There's no nothing. There's nothing that's going to stop them. So.
Oh, yes, there is.
But yes, Mister is. But it becomes a vigilante justice because there's no organized system. It's like he said, they don't deserve to live. Like, how are they going to contribute? What he's really saying is, how is letting those people live going to contribute to us trying to build a new world?
No, right.
We can't build a new world with animals like that running around.
Yep.
I mean, that was pretty much the way I saw it. I didn't even see it so much as they don't deserve to live. I almost saw it more like, look, this is a different world now, lady. We can't afford to be nice to these people.
Yeah.
Because they're just going to kill and murder and rape and whatever. Just get rid of them. They're nothing but trouble.
My vibe with it was actually like his savagery when he killed them was more like they hit their actions hit home with him or something like that. Cause I mean,
I could see that. Go ahead.
Because yeah. I mean, he goes ape shit on these guys. Like, I mean, it was enough that he throat punched one guy, let him drown in his own blood for a bit before he let him to his throat. But he threw that boomerang of justice, wherever the hell it was,
The boomerang of justice.
It wasn't the boomerang of justice, but that's awesome.
And let the guy thrive on the ground. And he was very, because compared to how very direct and serious he is with Martin, he acted very nurturing with the sister. You know, he's very, very soothing to her.
Well, and he does say to her, we don't do history. It doesn't do anybody any good.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a way of him saying, again, lady, this is a new world. We can't let rapists run all over the place here. This is not going to help anything. Like, if we can get rid of them, we should. But I agree with you, Abe. He did go ape shit. And that's really good what you said, because I did not pick up on that. But you're right. Maybe there was something that happened to him. Maybe that's a little piece of his backstory that we're just supposed to kind of fill in. You know, that's not really spelled out for us, that we're supposed to figure, hey, you know, maybe his grandmother was raped by somebody.
Well, I think he went
batshit when everything went to hell. You don't know. You know what I mean?
I think he maybe had a family, perhaps. I think he might have had a family.
Oh, I think he had a family too, because he makes comments later like, I am not your daddy, and all this stuff. And I think that's probably why he took the kid with him in the first place, respecting the father's wish.
I was just going to throw in there was also those scene where he, out of all the people that he, when they get to one of the shelters, out of all the people he danced, because there's a little dance going on, out of all the people she could dance with, he chooses the little girl there.
Yeah, that was a sweet scene.
Right, and Eric, it's interesting how you brought up, and I was going to bring up too, the Australian apocalyptic film that we both saw called These Final Hours. And this scene is almost similar to a scene in that, where the main character saves someone from rape and then just wipes them out because they're, at this point, they're useless in a sense. Mm-hmm. These type of people. And as Chrissy said, in this case here, where the world is post-apocalyptic, but not going to, you know, blow up like in that movie, that I just mentioned, these folks can't, help in, you know, recreating the world, redeveloping the world, because they're just sociopathic scumbags, basically. So that
well,
was
as it turns out, they're even worse than that, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a total non sequitur, but I just need to say it before I forget. Yep. On one of the podcasts that I was listening to in the car, I don't remember if it was Horsehead or maybe one of the other ones, you mentioned that documentary, the Dr. Moreau, behind the 1996 Dr. Moreau.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I rented that.
Oh, okay.
It was awesome.
Yeah, but yeah,
and I'm actually going to buy the Blu-ray of it because there's a ton of special features on it.
Nice.
But the reason I'm bringing that up now is because discussing this particular aspect of the story makes me want to go back and actually read the original Island of Dr. Moreau, because I think a couple of these issues are addressed in there, and I haven't reread that book in years, and it's about time I sit my ass down and reread it. So anyway, sorry. Right. Back on topic. Sorry.
No, but I do agree with you on that, because that story has a similar thing, like, you know, you mentioned Lord of the Flies and whatnot, or any apocalyptic type thing, where people digress to their most animalistic ways when, or their true nature in a society where there is nothing, and something like that. Dr. Moreau, that's why H.G. Wells' book is so important. I think too. Let's see here. I know, Eric, you're a little bit biased in the sense that people suck. So did you think they deserve their fate and were worth, as Chrissy said, worthless people? Let's just get rid of them because they can't help build society.
Yes.
Good answer, I guess.
because I think that, I mean, in some ways, sometimes you just can't save people. And in an environment like this where it really truly is life or death, it's a choice between, are we going to struggle to survive and build a new society, or are we just going to let the animals take over and run the world? That's your choice. There really isn't a choice.
Yeah.
You either succumb to some it or you overcome it.
Well, and here's the other thing is, what's the other option? Saying, right.
Yep.
Hey, guys, could you please try not raping anybody?
Quite nice.
How do you think they're going to respond to that?
Could you please keep your dick in the pants for a little while because we're trying to rebuild a new society?
You know, now, it's no, I mean, seriously, it's day on the apron.
All right. I'm sorry.
It's just,
well, let me ask you this, because eventually we get a scene where we get we discover that the people that they killed were part of the religious crazies, and we're not talking about the sister / nun. We're talking about people who become fundamentally insane.
They're crazy, and have
bastardized religion into something that some would argue isn't what it was supposed to be. As you could say, you know, in various cases in today's society or today's world, I should say. So what happens is we discover that one of them happens to be the son of the leader of this religious cult that's in this general area of Pennsylvania, New York, and so forth. But before I ask my question, Abe, what were you going to say?
I was going to comment that to get an idea, give folks listening an idea of just how crazy these guys are, they actually believe the vampires are a punishment from God. They were sent down. This plague of bloodsuckers was sent down to punish humanity and to purify the bloodlines.
Yes.
And not only that, they actually use these damn things in their own warfare against the survivors. Like they do in one scene later on.
Right, and we'll discuss that when we get to it. Now, let me ask you this question. How did these religious cult people know that Mister killed the son of the leader of that group? Because I didn't see where that happens, and they never addressed it.
I think he figured it out. Because when I mentioned that he left the other guy, he threw the boomerang of justice at on the ground, dying. I think he didn't take the weapon out or finish him and left him there to suffer. But members of the group found him because the main antagonist mentions he suffered for 3 hours, and I bet he told his father.
Oh, you're right. He wasn't
that
dead.
Who did
you're
it?
Right. Yeah, right. He wasn't dead.
Well, and that actually is a disturbing thing when the father says, because it almost humanizes
right.
this guy who was raping. He says he cried for his mother for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And that almost made you feel, it made me feel almost sympathetic. Like this movie had an uncanny way of making everybody human. There were really no, like, people that were so evil, you totally hated them. I mean, you hated Jebediah, but you didn't hate him completely because you could see toward the end of the film, he believed that he was a god, that he had also gone crazy through all of this. But anyway, we'll get back to it.
Right, Christy, he's like one of those people that if the world didn't go to shit, he may have not been a true sociopath, and he could have been still just a normal guy that was mowing his lawn and drinking a beer.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that also that scene with the son where he said he cried for his mother for 3 hours and he was my son. I mean, the emphasis there was he was my son. Every time he came back, it was like he was my son. So he was a human being. He wasn't a total, you know, just shallow character.
That was interesting that you mentioned that, Chrissy, because the Lord of the Flies, we have dozens of children in that, and a lot of them become evil psychos. But you can't believe the random luck that every child that got crash landed and were on that plane that survived in Lord of the Flies was a psychopath from birth. And so what it happens is they become evil, or they become crazy, or they break down and more animalistic because of their surroundings, not because they were psychopaths from the beginning. And so that makes it even more scary to think that this guy or anybody in this world becomes bad because of of the breakdown or the craziness of what's going on, specifically rather than just them being programmed to be psychopaths from the moment they were, you know, born, like a lot of people are.
Oh, and I actually do have a question, because after he rescues sister, right, they go to this motel. They shack up in this motel. I'm hoping one of you guys can answer this question for me. Why do they put traps all around the hotel to know that the vamps are coming, but then they paint a teddy bear with blood to attract them? Does anybody understand that? Because I was like, wouldn't you not want them anywhere near there? Why the fuck would you do that?
I
didn't get that.
It could be Mr. just because he... Because Mr. is a hunter, even though he is what is part of his other duties protect Martin. He seems to just his calling for the good part of it has also been eliminating any vampires he comes across and takes any opportunity to take one down.
But if he's got the sister with him and the kid, I just didn't get why he would deliberately try to attract one.
I don't think it makes a difference to him whether they're around or not.
No. You know, he may be soft at times, but he seems to put his the training and killing vampires first at times.
Whether that's a good enough explanation for you, Chrissy, I don't know, but that's possible. I mean, it's a good point though. It's a good question.
Oh, and I love that thing where she knew her. That's Sister Agatha.
Thought
she was dead. And then
after
she dies, the nun goes and closes her eyes.
Yep.
And then Mr. buries her.
Oh, that's
and
right.
And the kid even says, I think he feels bad for her because he's burying her friend.
Yeah.
So we're already seeing Mr. kind of go on his journey toward emotional healing as well.
Yeah. But he still takes the teeth out, according to the kid.
That's true. Yeah, because he collects the teeth. Yeah, right.
Well, they need that because they have to go buy booze in the next town. What are they going to buy it with?
That's right. And to be honest, the teeth are only an aspect of the loss of her humanity and aren't really part of her anyway. So if you pull the teeth, so it's a foreign parasite rather than part of the body when you think about it. So it doesn't disturb me that much, but I see your point or the oddity anyway of it, Abe. Now, let's talk about what happens when they get captured by these people. We talked about the Jamestown situation where they hear this baby at a revival tent, and they go into the tent and they see all these dead people that appear to have drank like a Kool-Aid. A baby's crying in the bassinet at the center near like a quote unquote altar. And they go over to and find out it's just a tape recorder playing a baby crying. And then suddenly all the people who we thought were dead were not dead. And they pull out guns and they're captured. And then Christy, you mentioned how the guy was talking about you killed my son and he cried for 3 hours and so forth. But an interesting aspect is that basically he's going to kill the mister as revenge by having him get eaten by the vampires. Then he takes the nun or sister as a sex slave. So we're talking about similar to, I guess, not to bring up real world, but ISIS, where we hear that the leader of ISIS is capturing non-believers and using them as wives and sex slaves in Syria, and this is what 5 years before this even occurred in the real world, and yet oddly it plays so true to today. And then of course the boy Martin is going to be just basically forced to become a member of this church. What do we guys want to talk about here before we get into the Danielle Harris character? Because this is the right before that.
We touched on the main points already, which is that this cult leader actually becomes kind of human in your eyes when he starts talking about his son. And that brought some ambiguity for a little while, at least.
Yeah, if he's a bad guy or not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly he's the bad guy, but
right.
You understand his motivation, at least.
Right, and to be honest, right. I mean, the one thing they do heavy-handedly to make us not like him, because you can argue all this prior you could still like him, even though because you know you killed my son. I'm gonna put you to death for killing my son. Whatever, whatever. We haven't seen them really do anything bad, and you know he wasn't there when his son was quote unquote trying to rape the nun. So, you know, maybe he didn't know his son had become a scumbag. And then, but suddenly,
I don't think he cares, considering that he's no different.
Well, that's what we find out is it becomes heavy handed by him taking her, the nun, as a sex slave for himself. At that moment, we decide, okay, this guy's a really bad guy. He's not really just someone that's leading this camp of people who just had a son killed. In other words, this would be, I'm trying to be Mike here saying, it was very heavy handed that to prove that he was a bad guy, they showed him as a rapist.
Well, okay.
You know, I mean, at least that's what how
I don't think it was out of bounds.
No, I'm not saying it was. I'm just saying that had he not taken her as a sex slave, or in other words, him being a rapist, we wouldn't necessarily know that he's a bad guy.
Well, and here's the thing, though. First of all, yeah, just look at him. Second of all, he's the bad guy. You can tell by just looking at him. But the way he talks about Sister, to me, it didn't strike me as, oh, yes, let's take her as a sex slave and get our rocks off. To me, it came across more as, oh, well, she is a viable human woman that might be able to produce children, so let's do that with her. So it seemed less of a perverted sex thing and more of a continue to populate the human race thing.
Interesting.
I almost saw that he wanted to get revenge on her and procreate with her so he could kind of have his son back.
Huh, that's an interesting take.
Yeah. Maybe I'm going a little far. I'm probably going way too far with that, but that was what...
I mean, it's an interesting interpretation, but we never get enough time with Jebediah to get a complete idea what his psychology is.
No, except at the end when he says, I am a god. I prayed to God and he listened to me. And so I think going with whichever one of you said that he wanted to procreate to repopulate the earth, that makes sense in the context of the end where he's like, I am a god. Because he literally does say at the end, I am a god.
Well, here's the thing, though. Well, we'll talk about that when we get there. I have a lot to say about that particular scene.
Okay, cool.
All right, very well. So what's the next scene? I guess, is there anything else that we need to discuss before we get to the Daniel Harris and then the Marine characters? Because those
well,
are the two
he
next.
Dumps, he takes his name out to the desert and dumps them in the Valley of Them, Mister.
Yeah.
He does that. And then, but that's interesting too, because the kid goes out to find him. The kid needs to go back to the car. Martin wants to go back to the car. And he says, Mister taught me how to read the stars, which is also another Moby Dick illusion, because what do you do when you're on the ocean? You navigate by the stars.
Oh.
Besides vomit. You navigate by the stars. That was how they navigated. So here is Martin symbolically finding his way back to, quote, dry land to the car using the stars. Now, I actually cheated a little bit today because I was curious. I went on the Gutenberg Project. Have you guys ever heard of that?
Nope.
No.
Okay, the Gutenberg Project, you can Google it. They have a lot of texts of famous classic books online, word for word, for free, just on text on a website.
Yep, I remember that. It's basically all, what's it, common domain, or what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah.
Public domain.
Yeah, that's it.
So I found, I use that frequently if I'm doing research for something and I just want like a quick, like I don't want to get out my copy of Moby Dick and flip through it. I just want to, you know, like kind of search through a document and see what I can find. There are references to stars 14 times within the book of Moby Dick, but but each time it's referenced, it's significant. It's something symbolic, like it's we navigated by the stars, or Starbuck was hoping to see the Vermilion stars on the thing of his oar. So the stars are kind of an important motif in that book, but the reason I cheated and looked it up was because I wanted to be sure that it was actually sort of an allusion to Moby Dick in my own mind, or if I was just remembering it that way. But yeah, it's mentioned enough times I can justify it, so there you go.
Cool. And folks who want to check that website out, you just search right on Google, bring it right to it. I've used it a couple of times as well.
It's really great for researching, like just at the last minute, especially if you're looking for something very specific in a text and you don't want to sit there and search for 5 hours in your original copy of the book. You know?
Right. Yeah.
That's kind of why I call it cheating. It's not as much fun, but it gets you the answer in 10 minutes. You know?
Christy, I was giggling there. I wasn't laughing at you. I've been fighting my own brain during this entire episode. I really wish they'd named the main character in this movie something else, because every time you say the name Martin, I flash to the theme song from the sitcom starring Martin Lawrence.
Oh my
so
God.
Talking about Martin just here in my head. Martin!
Oh, goodness.
So that's what's going in my head right now.
Oh, goodness. All right. So, basically, they lose Sister because she is now captured by the bad guys.
And because she kind of dismisses Martin, because they're about to take her into this tent to do the sex slave thing. But she gives a nod to Martin, like, it's okay for you to go. I don't want to keep you here for my sake. Yeah. So she kind of dismisses him to send him on his way.
Yeah, and that was an important point, because he, later on, we discover, does not want to abandon her. Yet he probably wouldn't have even abandoned her at that point had she not dismissed him, like you said, Eric.
Well, he's like, she becomes his mother figure.
And he actually even says that, right? Doesn't he even say that, in a sense?
He kind of says that, yeah. But she does become his mother figure. So she has to let him go. And again, this is symbolic along his journey. You know, as he's letting go of the substitute mother, he eventually lets go of other things. You kind of see them, like, the deck of sex cards that he finds in the house later is also kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what happens is he finds the car, right? And then Mister pops up out of the trunk. That was so awesome.
That was pretty awesome.
I was so not expecting that. I was like, hey. And then there's this whole thing where the vampire, they can't get her off the car. And she's just hanging out. That was awesome, too. That was a great scene. But then eventually they kill her. And this is where we find out they've made it as far as upstate New York. They've made it as far as Sullivan County.
Okay.
So, and that's when they end up in the bar, Phil.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Where they see the pregnant girl. Belle, her name is.
Yep, Belle. And that woman is played by Danielle Harris. And actually, this is the first film I've ever seen Danielle Harris in. I didn't even know who she was.
Really?
Until this film. But then again, as I've kind of alluded to recently, I didn't really get back into modern horror until about 6-7 years ago anyway. And because I was really more just into dramas and things like that. So when I saw this film, this was the first time I had seen her. So yeah, but she's become like a pretty big cult figure in the horror community, I guess. She does all the conventions and whatnot. What do we want to discuss about her character? Because she is singing at a bar. She's obviously older than Martin, but you can tell Martin likes her, probably sexually. I mean, she's an attractive woman, whatnot.
Well, good God, man. He's a teenage boy. He likes everybody sexually.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, at least everybody that's a female.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe some trees, too.
Yeah.
Maybe he even puts his hands under tables occasionally.
I'm sorry.
I had to.
That's right. And then, of course, they leave this town, and they find out is trying to get somewhere, and they pick her up as they're about to leave the town because she wants to go north or New Eden or whatever as well.
Well, she wants to get to New Eden before her baby is born.
That's right. That's exactly
right. But she's being really kind of seductive to him in the bar, right? There's that one scene where she's like rubbing her belly and looking at him, and he's looking at her.
Yeah,
does anybody remember that?
I don't know if that's a form of seduction.
Look at my baby. I really don't think that's what she was doing. I think she just did it having to cut eyes with each other.
Come on over here and poke my baby in the eye, big boy.
But to be honest, it could be also. It also could be her or his imagination, where she wasn't doing it sexually, and in his eyes, since he, you know, like you said, Eric, a teenager.
Oh, you're saying that that's what he saw, not what she was actually doing.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'll buy that. Yeah,
I mean, you know, so that's a possibility. Why not? You know, because, I mean, this is hormones control a kid, right?
Yeah, that's true.
what else? So she's they willingly take her. What happens next? Is it when they get to the village and they find sister again, or?
Well, I think they run into the Marines next.
Oh, you could be right. Yeah, I think you're right.
So you got your notes there?
Yeah, the Marine. If not, we could just go right to the Marine scene. Why don't we do that?
Okay. So Mr. And the rest of the gang is just going about taking care of a vampire as usual. Until they realized someone's in the outhouse. I think the vampire was standing outside. By the way, this vampire was dressed up as Santa Claus.
Yeah, that's right.
makes you wonder just how long this apocalypse is going on for.
Yeah. It was curious that they had the vampire dressed as a Santa Claus. Obviously, it was intentional. Whether it was intentional because they thought it was funny, meaning the writer and director, or they wanted to, say something about something.
I kind of bought the whole killing of the Santa Claus thing as the, how do I phrase this? The final vanishing of all that we kind of dress up as religious nicety in our society. In other words, when we think Christmas, it's religious, right? Because it's Jesus was born and came to redeem us and all that stuff.
Yep.
But Christmas is sort of the civilized face that we put on that. It's like the happy face that we put on that. Like the commercial sort of happy, like, you know what I'm saying? And
I
so
do.
Them shooting the Santa Claus to me was almost like that kind of happiness is never really going to come back. Like no matter how they restructure their society, they're never going to have that lightness again.
Yeah,
they're never gonna have it. And it does come right after that scene where we see the child vamp, which is where he hesitates and doesn't kill her right away.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So it was almost like a murdering of his own childhood, a murdering of his own childhood, his innocence.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, I did love that scene where the girl was sleeping and then her head cracked up. That was totally creepy. That was the scariest thing in the film.
That was so
fucked up. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to have nightmares about that. I'm going to have to
put the
lights on.
Well, which was awesome. This? The girl in the attic?
In the attic.
Yeah,
and the way she opened her eyes and she looked normal, But then,
she just smiles with the
does that unnatural thing. Oh my god, that was so freaking. Was genius. That was really scary.
And it kind of shows that there's underlying levels of certain levels of intelligence amongst the vampires. Some are just completely bestial. This one's just very sadistic, childlike. Like it was.
Well,
just,
because then she comes downstairs and she's touching him.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Was that okay? Is she intelligent and doing that to just be mean to the human, or is there part of humanity left in her and is she trying to make a connection?
It's hard to say.
I took it as B, as option B, Eric.
Okay, me too.
You know how I took it? I took it as because they kept on saying that the oldest vampires are berserkers or are further away from their humanity. This girl must have been a beginning vampire.
When because she looks nowhere near as fucked up as the other ones. Like she looks almost like human.
But getting back to the Santa Claus, he has trouble killing her, and then the shooting of the Santa Claus almost signifies the final loss of his childlike innocence because he couldn't kill her. But then he does, right? Doesn't he kill her? He does, but he hesitates first.
Actually, I think Mr. Officer.
Does he? Okay, I can't. I was kind of lost during that scene. I was watching it at work, actually.
Yeah, I forget.
On my phone. I might have looked away for a second.
I think Mr. takes the reins and has to offer because the guy's like having the same doubt I did about it. Is there still a human in there somewhere?
Right, and then Mr. kills the Santa Claus, right?
No, it was Martin kills the Santa
Martin kills the Santa Claus. So it's almost like Martin saying, okay, I am ready to kill my childlike innocence. I just did it.
Yeah,
I shot Santa Claus. So, sorry. Yeah. Didn't mean to get us off on another thing, but...
And thus began the year without a Santa Claus.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Hey, that's awesome. Oh, Jesus.
I'll have a blue Christmas.
all right, so... So then they find a Marine. Marine was basically left by the cult to I don't know as bait for the vampires or something. And then we get an exposition scene from him about what happened in the Middle East and that, you know, the world's all screwed up and whatnot. Pretty much the exposition of basically saying that.
Yes, it's worldwide.
Yeah, it's worldwide, exactly. And so he joins the group. So he becomes another part of the quote-unquote family that is created by this group of survivors that are trying to, whatever. It's just a family, in a sense, you know, a family structure.
And he's the messenger because he kind of fills in...
The harbinger.
The harbinger, yes. He kind of fills in a few pieces of information about, like, well, that's why Washington went down. Because remember, there's that scene where he says that's how they took Washington?
Yeah.
That the Christians set up these traps or something. I can't quite remember what it was. Mm-hmm. Maybe one of you guys does. But he kind of says that. And in the meantime, Martin has found these sex cards in the house that he's taken with him.
Yes, yes. And basically, sex car. I mean, obviously, that was thrown in again because what do you think it was just thrown in to remind us that he has a kid that is out of his element and whatnot? Or, that he's young and stupid and the coming of age story? Or do you think that it meant anything else than that?
No, I think it's part of his coming of age journey.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Because at the end, he finally meets the maiden and he becomes a man.
That's right.
So, yeah. But anyway, we'll talk about that later.
when I get there. All right. So the group heads to a new town. Another
Strivington.
Yeah, and that's right. They renamed the town to Strivington. That's right. Which I still don't believe they would do. I would think they would just keep the name, whatever Danbury or New Arbor or Ann Arbor or whatever the fuck it's called. But either way, it's named Strivington now, and it's a haven, a safe place, basically, it seems, right?
Yeah, did anybody catch the symbol, though, of the deer with the crown of thorns on its head?
Oh, I mustn't. Shit. I didn't know.
Eric, what about you, Eric? Did you see it?
That was really...
Not at all. I was just laughing that Abe's swearing at himself.
Explain.
There's an image of a deer when they get into Strivington. It's a buck, and it's got the crown of thorns. It's probably barbed wire, or they've wrapped it to a fence or something with wire, but it looks distinctly like a crown of thorns. And that was, again, where we were talking about the heavy-handedness. I was like, oh, my God, really? Because, like, deer, especially bucks, are a symbol of leadership. In witchcraft, they are. I don't know what they mean in other things. I don't know what they mean in dreams. I'd have to look that up. And I didn't have time to look that stuff up because, yes, I do have to look that stuff up. But I do know that in witchcraft, if you see a buck, it's a sign of leadership. It's a sign that you are supposed to be a leader. And it was interesting to me that they put this image in there because to me it was almost like, okay, they're crucifying the fact that there is nowhere that they're safe. There is no person who can be a leader who can, you know, put this world back together. So here they arrive in this safe haven. And the second thing we see once they get inside those gates is this buck that has a crown of thorns on its head. And I was like, okay, this paradise is not going to last long because that tells me that there is no safe haven.
Interesting. So, and sure enough, they do.
And it's
find
a quick
out.
Second. I mean, if you blink, you miss it, but it is in there. So anyway.
Now they meet the sister again. She has somehow escaped and is now in this safe haven. This is where Mike, if he was here, would say, now that was way too coincidental. In a good story, when people separate in a huge land like the US of A in an apocalyptic area, you'd never see the people again. So I can't believe that it was just coincidence they would meet up again. And
good job, Phil.
Thank you. Thank you. And to be honest, Mike would have a valid point. I could see him saying that and saying, yeah, that's a good point, Mike. But, you know, we'll forgive it, you know, nitpick. But either way, they get her again. And there's a big celebration that night at this town. And what happens here, Eric?
What happens here is one of the more unique forms of warfare I've ever seen. basically, there's a party going on in the town, and then some helicopters start flying over. Nobody knows what's going on, and it turns out it's the religious kooks, and they're bombing the town with vampires. They're throwing vampires out of helicopters. The vampires land, and apparently that doesn't kill you if you're a vampire. And they get up and start chasing after people and eating them. It's fairly effective. I mean, they ended up putting the vampires down and salvaging the town, but they certainly take some casualties along the way.
Yeah. But I just, like, I guess it would make sense they'd be able to drop them without killing them because I remember several scenes, vampires get shot in the head and they still keep going.
No, it makes sense. It's surprising. When I first saw this scene, it surprised me that nobody had thought of that before.
In a movie or book.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, it surprised me that that's the first time I'd seen it. I was like, you know what? That's kind of awesome.
There would have to be a lot of preparation because you have to catch the damn vampires. Strap them to something, carry them in a helicopter, and then find a way to throw them onto your target. I just tried to picture.
That's an Olympic event.
There you go.
Vampire throwing.
Now, I didn't get this, but if you were bit by one, do you become a vampire?
Yes.
I was not clear on that either.
If you don't die, then you become a vampire.
Yeah, because they you know, like a zombie apocalypse or whatever, you know, or 28 days later or whatever. If you get bit, you become a zombie. but here, they never really state it, right? I mean, it's never part of the exposition, right? Yeah.
No, they don't state it. Yeah. So.
Yeah, it was just something curious that I was wondering about. Yeah.
Well, and what's interesting is that in the morning, they kind of hole up. And then there are, he says 10 dead. There are 10 people dead. And we see the little girl that Mister was dancing with.
As one of the dead?
We see her legs.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And Martin, and the shot on that was so obvious. And then again, this is why this movie's a little heavy-handed. Then the next scene, Martin goes, I'll never forget the image of the dead girl's legs. I was like, oh my God, really? Like, cause they focused in on it for 3 seconds.
Or so now you gotta talk about it too.
So now we gotta talk, now you gotta talk about it. Yeah. But what's interesting also, going back to the symbol of the buck with the crown of thorns on its head. And again, this is religious symbolism, but there are 10 horns on the beast.
What the fuck? You counted them?
Well, no, he says there's 10.
Oh, he actually,
So in the Revelation, when they talk about the beast has 10 horns.
All right.
I'm sorry. I should have made that clear. But the beast has 10
horns. The movie horns. To count the horns on the buck, and that's
No. The beast in the Revelation, they say the beast with 10, I think it's horns, right? It's not heads, it's horns.
Yeah, right. It's horns.
Oh, God, my religious parents are trying in their grave that I can't remember exactly what it is. But
call your sister.
Well, you
right, it's call my sister. My sister would know. Right. My sister would totally know. But anyway, and the thing is, a lot of Christians, okay, and I'm talking about probably a little bit more toward the extreme right, okay, are convinced, even in the 70s and 80s, they were convinced, that the common market in Europe is the beast with 10 horns.
Yeah, that's from the Omen.
Yes, right. But I mean, there's a reason that's in the Omen. Like, it was already being discussed. That was not something that was made up. That was already being discussed.
And the common market, meaning what is today the European Union. Yeah, the EU.
Yeah, but what's interesting about that is that that's supposed to be a big society now, or that was supposed to be the magical human society. So again, we have this whole idea that they're never going to be able to form a perfect society again, because it has now been slaughtered.
Yeah.
So, I see what you're saying. So I just wanted to throw that in there, but.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's get to the last few scenes.
They leave the town. They keep driving north. They end up in the Adirondacks. The car dies, and he can't fix it this time. So they end up in the woods, trekking through the mountains. They find a junkyard. They hole up in the junkyard, and this is where that whole very obvious Mary and Joseph statues come in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like the symbol that Belle and Martin are going to be the bringers of new life, sort of, because Belle is getting more toward her due date. In the junkyard, they're attacked. They all run into a cornfield. The nun can't outrun the vamps. She sees a scarecrow that clearly looks like Christ on the cross.
Yeah.
And she says, blatant. Forgive me, Lord, and blows her brains out with the gun.
That scene really kind of hit a chord with me, because I was like, oh, man, the nun just committed suicide.
Yeah.
That's pretty bleak.
Indeed, it is.
Yeah, but that scarecrow was so obviously like Jesus with the shroud and the, you know, the typical religious symbolism that you see on Easter Sunday, you know, where they put the shroud over the cross.
Right.
It was brilliantly done. I mean, it was beautifully rendered. It was, you know.
Well, that makes me bring up the fact that, you know, the Mike thing here. It's impossible for them to just suddenly randomly meet each other again after being separated. However, because, and especially when you think, oh, they just kill off the nun in the next scene anyway. So what the hell was all that about? It was pretty much, I guess, about this. So what was the point of having this, you know, Christ figure cross and the nun blowing her brains out, except to say what? Were they trying to say that?
Religion in its pure form.
Yeah.
Is dead. That's what I got out of it. that, again, in this new world, we have another symbol of organized religion, which, you know, I have my opinions about that. They don't belong here. But religion, the civilized ideas of religion, our structure of religion, because, you know, nuns, she's a Catholic nun.
Yep.
Catholic nuns are very structured. It's all about structure. Yep. There is no more structure in this new world. So her killing herself also represents the death of structure, that society will not be restructured.
Of organized religion.
Right. Because organized religion is yet another component of civilized society, quote, end quote. All right. So. And then they hike deeper into the mountains and they find a bus.
Yeah, because they're the car.
Abandoned bus.
Yeah, because they don't have a car anymore. And they find this abandoned bus and they decide to use that to sleep in. And I immediately, after rewatching it, because I had forgotten exactly how they get, will get, you know, the next scene occurs. But I immediately thought, okay, you're going to use a bus as a place to sleep. That would be an obvious place to sleep. Therefore, I figured that it was going to get rampaged by, you know, hooligans or bad people because, you know, when you're not going to just sleep under a tree, you're going to sleep in a bus. And so that would be an obvious place for anybody, good people or bad people, to go if they saw.
Well, so, and there are also two or three really important things here that foreshadow what's about to happen to Belle's baby and Belle.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, the baby starts kicking and it starts snowing. Well, no, actually, the first thing is the owls start hooting at night.
Okay.
In common New England superstitions. Now, I'm going back to early New England, like what they brought over from, you know, overseas, okay?
Yeah, the old country, as my grandfather used to call it.
Right, the old country, okay? And even my grandmother was a Czech when it was still Czechoslovakia, you know, and she had this superstition too, which is why
No way! You're not just Norwegian! Okay, sorry.
No, I'm really not. I'm actually a melting pot of all kinds of shit. But anyway, my grandmother used to say that when you hear an owl hooting at night, it means that a baby is going to die.
Those damn hooters.
Yes. So the second I heard the owl hooting at night, now that's not something anybody would pick up probably, but a weirdo like me, but I picked up on that. I went, oh, this is not good. The second thing right after that is the baby's kicking. She's like, feel the baby kicking, and it starts snowing. The first snow means death to all things. It's going to sleep for the winter. Yeah, so I was like, okay. All right, the third thing, we hear the owl hooting at night again when the Marine goes out to pee. I'm like, that's it. She and the baby are dead. Like, I knew they were going to die the second we got those three things. Now, I don't know, like I said, if that was done intentionally. It's an old world superstition, so it's very likely that somebody else knows this, I'm sure.
You well, could probably and here's find the thing it on the internet,
I guess, but
I highly doubt that random owls started hooting while they were shooting this movie there. That's probably a sound that was put in intentionally afterwards, so I can't imagine it was a mistake.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with Eric.
Because that's what it kind of said to me.
Yeah,
but it's interesting. Because remember I said in some religions in an earlier episode of the show, I told you guys too, which is also true, that an owl can also mean the presence of a soul that has passed that's trying to communicate with you. But that's why I said it just depends on what belief system or what religion you're dealing with or whatever, because it means 5,000 different things. You just got to translate it the way that kind of works, you know, for whatever it is you're trying to figure out. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, and that's fair because, Eric, you have a good point there, which is, you know, just happen to be able to pick up an owl hooting in the background or maybe, oh, we need night track. So let's buy this, you know, off of some guy and put it in the film because we need a night track. But, again, we're talking about Dimitri and Mikkel and all their other quote unquote symbolism and things that they've been trying to say. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if this was all intentional. I mean, you know, if they're putting in a deer with a barbed wire or a scarecrow or, you know, and on and on and on, no doubt that, Chrissy, I could see you being right on this one too.
Well, and I haven't seen any of the other movies that you've mentioned that this team duo has done. Yeah. And I'm now intrigued. And I want to go look at some of those other films because I bet they probably load them with stuff.
Well, yeah, absolutely. All of them are pretty heavy-handed, except for maybe Cold in July, because it, and that one has a lot of symbolism too, but that one is the only one that was actually from a source material, Gerard Lansdowne book. But yeah, you should definitely check their other work out. So first off, the Marine is found dead.
Yep.
All right. So he's killed, and not just killed, but he's hanging in a tree.
Right.
And then Daniel Harris's character disappears. And this is where they start saying that there's something odd going on because they believe that there's now smart vampires and they've never seen a smart vampire before. At least Mister hasn't. So mm-hmm.
He calls them thinkers. I've never seen a thinker. Yeah.
So let's talk about what happens now. So the Marine is dead. So two major characters are dead. Their family is now dwindled down to three. And then Daniel Harris's character disappears too. So now their family's down to two. What happens here? What do we want to discuss?
Well, basically, they hear her screaming from a distance. And
Belle disappears. They go camp somewhere and Belle disappears.
Well, that's the Daniel Harris.
Because guy. The dude, the thinker vampire, distracts them or whatever, and they chase mm-hmm. after it. But anyway, go on, Eric. Sorry. Just wanted to
So they hear her screaming and Martin goes to run after her, and Mister's like, You know that's a trap. And he's like, I don't care. I'm going anyway. So he runs into this. What is this place? This is like a windmill or
it's a barn.
A barn, okay.
Yeah, it's an old.
It's a silo. It's actually in a silo. That what the actual thing that takes place.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like an old. Yeah. It's like an old upstate New York because by this time they're really up there. Uh-huh. Like they're up at the tippy top of the Adirondacks, and a lot of the barns there have that Dutch design to them. She's kidnapped by this vamp. And what Eric said, he goes in after her.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about this is upstate New York.
Oh, it's clearly upper. Yeah, it's like way upstate because, and I think Eric would agree with me too because he grew up there, mm-hmm. that a lot of those barns and silos have that very distinct, because that area was all settled by the Dutch. So it's all like that very distinct kind of Dutch looking barns and Dutch looking silos, you know, with kind of the colonial Dutch sort of,
that's probably why a windmill popped into my head.
Roofs. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Cause it did kind of look like a windmill, but that area up there, especially, near as I can figure, I think they're up near where my sister used to live. I'll have to get her to watch this movie and actually look at it, but that's kind of what
I thought your sister lives in Texas.
She does now, but she used to live in way upstate New York.
Oh, I get you.
Like way upstate, like on an Indian reservation upstate. Like, yeah. Right. She camped and she's thinking about moving back next year. And I'm like, oh my God, really? Please don't. I like visiting you in Texas. I really don't want to go to upstate New York. Ow. Way upstate anyway, but yeah. So near Canada, like right near the Canadian border. Right. So, yeah. So, anyway. So, Eric, take it from here.
Basically, Martin goes charging after the pregnant girl. And we come to find out that waiting for them in the barn is the leader of the religious cult that they had run into earlier, who is now vampified.
Directly because of them, right? Because they... Yeah. Get the revenge on him earlier in the film. We skipped over that whole scene, mm-hmm. and they leave him to die by vampire, basically. However, it appears something else happened.
Oh yeah, he pretty much explains that because he gave his blood willingly to the vampires, he remained sentient and he retained his identity.
Right. And this is where he says, "I am a god."
Well, and here's the thing. Okay. How is he wrong?
I have to agree.
I mean, if he, because this is the first time anybody knows of this happening ever, right? Of somebody becoming a vampire and maintaining their own identity.
Well, you know what this it explains? What this explains is that the vampire virus isn't really just a virus, but it is actually
supernatural as well.
Exactly. A supernatural thing between God and Satan or some sort of religious thing.
Wow, I didn't even get that. That's
because
cool.
Yeah, because he got that, you know, so that turns the film around as now, okay, it's not just, you know, like a zombie apocalypse, vampire apocalypse. It's actually a spawn of some evil supernatural thing or something. Because
so theoretically, he could go back to his former cult, even though he's a vampire. He's retained his identity. He's still recognizable as who he was. And he could induce his followers to also freely give their blood to the vampires and end up with a culture of religious vampires.
It seems that way. Or at least have them become followers of him. You know, maybe it's just a quote unquote evil miracle, and it can't just happen to anybody and everybody. But either way, you're right. He could form a cult where he would be a vampire that leads a group of humans. Mm-hmm. Almost.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So this happens, and Mister runs in to try and save Barton. Because Barton's in way over his head trying to fight this guy. And again, with the heavy-handed religious imagery, I don't think I need to talk about what it symbolizes when this guy just proceeds to drive stakes through Mister's hands into the wall.
Oh, yeah. That yeah. was so... And it was also very reminiscent of the last shot of the Gregory Peck Moby Dick film, where he's tied to the whale and his right. hands are staked on the sides.
Yep.
I mean, I think that's in the book too, but that was the first image that came to my head. I'm like, oh, look, Ahab and his white whale. Yay. My dad would be so proud of me right now.
So basically the evil vampire guy, he gets caught monologuing.
Mark, that went a little long for me, actually. It was like, as you know, Bob, this is what happened to me. I was like, okay.
Right. So,
it was the James Bond villain, speech.
Yes. Well,
have any of you seen The Incredibles?
No. Yes, I love The Incredibles.
Because the fact that they called that out in that movie is priceless. Phil, you've got to see it if you haven't.
Oh, it's such a clever, it's so clever. Phil, if you haven't seen that movie, you have to see it. It's great. You'll love it, yeah.
So anyway, the vamp gets caught monologuing, and Martin's had a chance to recover and takes out, what was his name, his actual name?
Jebediah,
thank you. Takes out Jebediah.
Which, pretty obvious.
That's what I was about to say, too. That's an obvious biblical name. Yeah, right.
Went, my name is Jebediah Lovin or whatever. And I was like, oh, my God, really? Couldn't you just call him Dave?
But somehow they would turn Dave as King David. So, you know what I'm saying?
Well, that's true. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, why didn't they call him Nigel?
Yeah.
Nigel the vampire. Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead, Eric.
So Martin manages to off Jebediah, but it's too late, and Belle dies. Actually, I think he kills her, doesn't he?
Yeah, he stakes her because she's going to start turning because she was bitten.
Right. So he stakes her. First he uncrucifies Mister, and then he stakes Belle. And then collapses in tears in Mister's arms.
That's right. And Mister was like holding him, like, why are you holding, like, this, you know, weird affection. What is this?
But Mister has already kind of gone through his journey, too, because he was carrying Belle when she couldn't walk, and, you know.
Let's not forget that Mister has huge bleeding holes in his hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it might have been a little weird to return the hug fully.
That's actually a fair point, Eric. Fair point.
Yeah. So then they finally kill Jebediah, which actually I would like to interject that although they chose a really heavy-handed name, there was one moment there where he was monologuing and talking about how he was a god, where I almost got the sense that that wasn't his real name, that he picked that for himself.
I buy that. Yeah, exactly.
It was just one moment. I don't know what it was, but it was like a look in his eyes or something he said, and I went, oh, my God, he picked that. That's not his real name.
Yeah, I can buy that. Absolutely.
His name is probably Jack or something.
So let's wrap up. Let's wrap up the film because we've been going on for a while. So how do we end the film? Let's talk about how he's now like a completely different person after this because he just discovered that he isn't like the Superman vampire killer that he thought he was. And then they have, and this is Mike again. I'll bring in Mike. Mike would say, so the Chekhov's gun is they show Mr. looking at himself in the mirror. And there's this little skull necklace around his neck, which they didn't show any other time in the film except right now.
Oh, yeah.
And then
that
the very next scene.
I'm sorry. They should have shown that at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
At least once. Because that was too obvious. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, apparently, from what I'm reading here on his Wikipedia page, there were 7 webisodes. They were acting as prequels for each character in the story.
That's true. Yeah. Yes. If you buy the Blu-ray, they have all of these webisodes, and a lot of them are like 30 minutes long. So it's like almost another movie that predates what we see here.
Oh my God, we actually have to get it now.
And some of them are directed by Larry Fessender, the producer, too. So, the Blu-ray is definitely worth. They got 2 commentaries. They got basically a second movie, which is like a prequel. But go on.
Okay, you changed my mind. I'm going to buy this one.
So, in the Mr. prequel story, Mr. apparently goes back to his home, his childhood home that's somewhere situated in the woods. And I didn't have seen it, but Mr. Reinforce was set here. He finds his father had to kill his mother because she was turning. But he was wounded or something like that, and he dies. And the skull pendant was Mr.'s father's pendant.
Right. But you know what? Then this is where Mike would come in again, because he brought this up in Lovely Molly, because we discussed in that film they had like an hour like webisodes about that too, a podcast, and he would go, but they should have had some of that referenced in the 2-hour movie that I'm watching now, because
I have to agree.
Everybody is going to have seen those webisodes.
I have to agree.
Right.
But the thing is, though, that now that I know that, Abe, that makes
Phil,
even
I'm taking a perverse pleasure in listening to you do your mic impression.
Thank you. I'm glad that I'm doing well.
But now that you said that, Abe, that makes even more sense, because this is the moment that I referenced earlier where we find out that the white whale, quote end quote, that Mister has been chasing this whole film is not to the vampires. It's not the religious cults. It is to get this boy to grow to manhood under his tutelage. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's his white whale that he's been chasing this whole film. The fact that he grows and changes and starts to become less of a cold killer and more of trying to find his humanity again, that's his character conflict crisis change that sort of happens like as a subplot. But that was his white whale. And what happens is they end up at this diner where there's this girl, Peggy, who is the maiden archetype. And she is finally the one who's meant to be with Martin. You kind of get that sense. Yep. And then what I found hysterical is the vampires come at night and she's shooting them because their bodies are littered all outside the diner. And she goes, oh God, it's Walter. I went to high school with him. He's such an asshole, but I can never get a clear shot. And Martin says, I'll go do it. And that's when he finally becomes a man, because the next scene is he wakes up in bed next to her and Mister is watching this.
Not them waking up in bed together, but watching Martin killing this vampire that the maiden. Yeah.
No, but Mister is sleeping in a chair and the two and Martin and Peggy are sleeping in bed together.
Right, each other. Right.
And then the next thing we see is Martin wakes up and Mister is not there.
Right. Now, let me ask you this.
Mister finished his job. He got him to manhood. He's in bed with a girl. He killed the rival, the high school asshole that was coming around. Yep, he did it of his own volition. After twice, he didn't want to kill. He was hesitating earlier in the film. Now he went out and did it. So that was his white whale and end of the Moby Dick comparisons. But yes, go on.
But why did he decide to leave the quote unquote family and right on the Canadian border, which is New Eden, and go off and do whatever he does?
Because at that point, he's the third wheel.
Yes.
So he's not the family anymore. And that's right. And his life really isn't to get to New Eden. His life was to get vengeance on this vampire plague for whatever it had done to him in these prequel webisodes, we can assume. Mm-hmm. He maybe had a family, like, you know, Abe said, the father and whatnot.
Right. But by fathering Martin, by getting Martin to be a man, which was his sense of duty in the beginning to Martin's biological father.
Yeah.
He has also completed his own journey. He's gotten vengeance in another way, not just by killing things, but by saying, I got this boy to manhood. This boy is going to now, I've done my job. Basically, I've done my job. It's time for me to go.
Yep.
That's why I was saying that was his white whale. That was what he wanted to conquer. Yeah. It wasn't only him conquering the vampire plague or getting vengeance. That's why his character softened during the movie. So at that point, he's fulfilled his duty. He's grown to become a new man within himself through this healing journey. And he's done his job. And it's time for him to go. And he just kind of realized that.
Okay, so I mean, he didn't have to.
He didn't have to. I don't think he had to.
Since the film is quote unquote very, I guess we could say symbolic, whether heavy handed or not, that was the way it was supposed to end. Versus him saying, "Let's all go to New Eden and see if we can form a new life." I guess.
Yeah.
I mean,
basically, he leaves his skull pendant and disappears.
Yep. And the boy takes Martin takes the skull pendant,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost like passing on.
Yes, you know, passing the torch. I mean, there's a lot going on, and if you follow it from the beginning of the movie, it does come to a complete arc, which is why I guess I didn't mind the heavy-handedness so much, because it was a complete arc. On all counts, it was, so.
Yeah. No, yeah, that's true. And it's almost like a sad ending for Mister, because even though, like you said, Christy, all these good things happened where he became a new man and blah, 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 it's almost like this is his dying as well. I mean, he's done.
He's like Bill Bixby at the end of an episode of The Incredible Hulk.
Oh my God, yes.
Because it's a sad, you're right, because it's a good, happy ending in the sense that he accomplished something and did good, but he can't stay because he'll still turn into the Hulk. In this case, he can't stay because his true nature, which is the hunter and all this, doesn't fit with the new life the boy has.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Martin's kissing Belle on the head when Belle has died, that was him saying goodbye to the baby, which we can now assume was probably a female. His baby sister, his sibling at the beginning.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yep. Yeah,
so he has, through the course of the movie, through all of these different people that he's lost, those people were not only archetypes, but they also became stand-ins for his family that he lost. Right. Mr. became his dad. The sister became his mom. Belle became his sibling that didn't live.
Yeah.
And he had to say goodbye to them at each stage.
Right.
And then he finally became a man at the end.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. To wrap up.
Ready for the sequel. Martin.
Getting it on in New Eden.
Now, to wrap up, we had like 2 hours worth of mini films and webisodes on the disc. I have not seen any of them. I didn't have time to.
I have to get this disc now. You guys convinced me.
I own a Blu-ray, but I have not watched any of those.
All right, I have to get it.
Yeah, so it'll be curious to see what is on those, but you know, none of us have seen them yet. And the commentary there, yeah, there's two commentaries, with the writer director and then one with the director and, all the, you know, the technical people as well. So to wrap up, let's just wrap it up. Eric, so why don't you give your final thoughts of this film?
I really like this film. I think it's a good non-Twilight-y vampire movie. The religious symbolism is a little bit heavy-handed, but I personally don't mind since my own tradition is not steeped in that. I could use a little assistance. I get why other people are a little meh about it, but it doesn't bother me personally. I thought all the acting in this movie was quite good. Of course, the story and the direction and all the fact that they're even paying attention enough to put symbolism in the movie is fantastic. So I can recommend this film wholeheartedly.
All right. Yeah, for me, I agree with Eric. I would recommend this film wholeheartedly. It's part of the new wave of vampires where vampires are almost like evil animalistic beasts rather than the Twilight or the Dracula type. So we're talking about like 30 Days of Night.
Yep.
Exactly. That type of vampire is also an apocalyptic film. So that's if you like apocalyptic films, that's pretty cool. The director and screenwriters are, you know, two of the better folks in genre today. So I definitely recommend just checking out for that. Definitely a good film. And looking to see what Mikkel and Dimitri do next, since they now have four fairly well films in the can. And this is not a bad one to start with, even though I watched them in order from Mulberry Street to Cold in July, which was based off of earliest to most recent. What about you, Abe?
I love this film. I thought this was a solid vampire flick. And especially considering it was made on such a low budget of only like $600,000. It was well acted. Everyone in the cast did phenomenal. I love the makeup designs of the vampires and just how they acted and behaved. I really did like the symbolism and the coming of age story with it. And considering, you know, there's small little stories, storylines of the webisodes that I haven't seen, it does make me eager to try find a copy and pick it up just to, get a full sense of who everyone is, because maybe there's some little bits of information that we didn't get, weren't told in the film itself, which is very likely. I give it as a high recommendation. If I would say even buy it, it's got a thumbs up from me.
Very good. And Chrissy?
Well, I'm just going to echo what everybody else said. I really enjoyed it, but I enjoyed it for probably different reasons from everybody else. If you're really sick of vampire films, if you hate Dusk Till Dawn, like some people do, if you hate Twilight, you need to get this film. It's good. But it's not about the horror. In fact, the only thing I would consider frightening in this is that one moment when the girl's head in the attic goes a little sideways, literally. The rest of it, it's really a coming of age story. And I would go even further and say, if you enjoy The Walking Dead, this is even better than The Walking Dead in terms of, how society falls apart. If you like Lord of the Flies, if you enjoyed, The Island of Dr. Moreau, no matter what film you like, which film version you like, or if you've read the book, this is probably a good thing for you to watch. And if you really love upstate New York, then definitely get this, because you're definitely going to see a lot of places that you recognize.
In Pennsylvania, too.
Yeah, and in Pennsylvania. I was pleasantly surprised. So if, you know, and yes, I'm going to go with Eric in the anti-Twilight. There are no sparkly douchebags in trees.
All right, very good. All right, so that's Stakeland, 2010 film by Mikkel and Dimitri. I recommend by all of us, probably a high recommend, whether it hasn't aged as well no matter, because it's still a great film and a great vampire film, a different type of vampire film, a different type of apocalyptic film, and a film that any genre fan should at least check out. All right, so with that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in tonight to listen to us talk about Stakeland. Come back next week. We'll have a different topic.
Find him.